Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL. Hey guys, this season, get football on your time with NFL Game Pass. That's what we use to watch all of our NFL action, and you also can catch every snap from every game with full game replays. See all the plays in just about 45 minutes with condensed games, and you can also relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every single week. This past weekend's Seahawks-Cowboys game, you can go back and rewatch, maybe not for Falcons fans, but rewatch that Bears comeback. It's all there. It's all the action, all the football you can handle all in one place. NFL Game Pass is the only place you can replay every game all season long. But the other cool part is you can also learn from the league's best players. With over 40 NFL Game Pass film session episodes, go inside the game from a player's perspective as they break down the game's concepts and techniques. Learn from the best like Deshaun Watson, Stephon Gilmore, Devontae Adams, and many more. NFL Game Pass also provides access to the entire awesome NFL Films archive. Go to NFL.com/Game Pass to start your free trial today. NFL Game Pass, where football never stops. Hey guys, I have to tell you about our friends over at Monkey Knife Fight, because all first-time depositors at Monkey Knife Fight that put at least $20 into their account while using the promo code PFF will receive, get this, a free PFF Edge annual subscription. This is a no-brainer because that's a $40 value for just $20, and you get the opportunity to turn that $20 into even more money playing daily fantasy and prop games at one of the fastest-growing fantasy sports sites in the USA in Monkey Knife Fight. So right now, do it right now. Go to Monkey Knife Fight, deposit your $20, put the promo code PFF in there, and you receive a free PFF Edge annual subscription. That's $40 value for just $20 at Monkey Knife Fight.
I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, fam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
PFF NFL Podcast Week 3 NFL is in the books. Steve Palazzolo here, Sam Monson. Why are you shaking your head at me, Sam?
You change up the intro. Why?
People try them all on.
People don't like it when you change the intro. You had a thing. You cultivated it carefully over 9 seasons, and now you change it up on people. They don't like it.
Listen.
I don't like it.
It's like a midlife crisis, changing my intro.
Well, those are coming down the road. Don't worry about it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast.
No, I don't like that. Stop.
I'm just trying to get right into the action. Let's do it.
Okay.
Every week, we always go back like 15 days to the Thursday night game, what it feels like. Not much to discuss here. Miami Dolphins, Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah, in the battle between beard and mustache, turns out beards are better, which some of us already knew.
That's it.
Now, this is interesting because obviously a beard man here, you have rocked a stash in the past. Ill-advised, some might say. you presumably were on the Minshew side of this.
I believe, well, I think the beard has more consistency.
Okay.
The mustache has more upside. So I think you saw.
Where's the upside in a mustache?
I mean, just Gardner Minshew throws together like a few good games, and all of a sudden he's like a
Talking player as opposed to facial hair at this point.
Yeah, I'm talking about like guys with mustaches have more upside, like Minshew.
Huh.
That's it.
Okay.
Anyway. But they also have lower lows, as we saw Thursday night. After we talked about tank-proof Minshew, he looked terrible, and Fitz had one of those games where he just does everything well.
Fitz, so since the start of 2018, Fitz has three games that are graded above 92 in PFF's system, which is insane, right? 90 is a crazy game. 92 is nuts. That's tied for the most in the NFL. So it's Fitzpatrick.
Maybe he's got higher.
Right. I think Breeze has three. I think Mahomes might have, like, whatever. It's like, it's the people you think it should be.
Yeah.
And then Fitzpatrick. So he had another one of those games, albeit aided by the fact that everything else was functioning. And then for Minshew, I think it was a real, like, lost opportunity. Like, you're not going to play in prime time very often. You get a shot to go out there and prove that you are better than this tank-proof guy who's still, you know, limited, but... And you didn't. And you didn't play very well. Albeit, you know, you didn't have Chark and blah, blah. There's some problems. But you didn't play well. Fitzpatrick on the other side did. And now you're back to being, well, you're tank-proof, but you might not be much better than that.
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't want to overreact to every single week.
Of course you do.
But with Minshew, overall, more good than bad. But this is kind of what happened last year, too. Like, as soon as you become a believer and as soon as we talk about Minshew magic in fourth quarter, there were some duds last year against the Saints. Broncos game where he had some ups and downs. I mean, that is where we are with Minshew. It's still a little bit of a roller coaster ride. Last week we were riding the high. Fitzpatrick is the master of the roller coaster ride, and he does have these games where he just can't miss and adds value as a runner.
God, he's so fun.
One of my favorite bits online, our friend Justice, he's always talking about, because he's like anti-volume stats when it gets to Hall of Fame. You know, so he's anti all the Stafford Hall of Fame people, Matt Ryan, some of these other guys. He's got some stat, like the only quarterback with X amount of passing yards and rushing touchdowns, and it's like Fitzpatrick in like all Hall of Famers. It's like Warren Boone and Fran Tarkington and all this stuff.
His career is going to end up being so funny because I've also seen in the last week people argue that like he's the worst long-term starting quarterback in NFL history. Like if you look at it, you know, one way, the whatever, it's 16 years of 14 different teams and blah, blah. Like, you can make a case that he's the worst long-term starting quarterback ever. And yet, as you say, if you look at it in a different way, you can carve his numbers to make him look really quite good.
He's now beaten the Jaguars with six different teams. That really sums things up. I think at a macro level, you know, Jacksonville's weaknesses were exposed a little bit. And I think Miami looked a lot more like that upstart young team with, you know, that's coming together. And I think that's my takeaway overall.
You know, when you get like a little clip of somebody and they pull up those like three nuggets, that's just three random bite-sized facts of information that sum that guy up. If I was Fitzpatrick after my career, that's the thing I would want as my point number one. Beat Jacksonville with six different franchises.
It is pretty impressive. So both teams to 1-2. After Thursday night football, another huge Thursday night football game. We'll get to that though. We're just gonna tease that for Thursday, the Thursday night preview.
Oh, that'll hook
for
him
Jets
in.
Broncos. All right, let's go through the Sunday slate in no particular order, other than the one that's given to me by PFF Ultimate. The Cincinnati Bengals and the Philadelphia Eagles. We have resident Bengals fan Mike Quinn. He's producing the show today. And I rolled in today and I said, it's tie Monday for you Bengals fans. 0-2-1 for both the Eagles and the Bengals.
This game was just bizarre. Like, we were like late, halfway into the 4 p.m. slate and this game was still going on with just neither of the teams wanted to win it. It was just blindly two punch drunk teams just slugging it out, hoping one of them eventually topples over. And then the most fitting ending of all, they both essentially determine at the same time, you know what, we're good with the tie. Like, let's just mail it in from here. No, I'm not going to take the shot at the kick. And no, I'm not going to attempt to do anything in the last 15 seconds. We're good. And ironically, Philadelphia did actually pick up ground on the rest of the division with the tie.
Yeah. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
Carson Wentz.
Still just awful.
He's got double the turnover-worthy plays of any other quarterback right now. And I think we talked about this off-air a little bit. I don't know if I mentioned on the other podcast. He might legitimately have the yips right now.
Yeah. You and I were talking about this before we went live. How do you fix that as a quarterback? Our guy Seth drew up this little video clip, and it's like he's not making bad decisions. Like, he still understands where to go with the ball. He's still trying to hit the right place. He just can't hit it. It's genuinely like a golfer with the yips, right? It's like, you know, your shot selection is fine. It's just that when you make contact with the ball, it fires 25 yards to your right into the trees. It's not going where it should go. And like, I don't know how you fix that with a start, because I think fundamentally the only way to fix that almost across the board is start over, hard reset, and come back and take another swing at it, right? But you're in the middle of a 16-game season. There's no reset point. Like, unless the bye week, you can try and do something. But like, there's no obvious reset. You need to actually sit that guy down and try and press the button. But you can't, like, as soon as you sit him down, you've just benched your starting quarterback. That may cause more problems than it solves.
Yeah. I mean, so the baseball example,
okay,
you get the yips. I mean, your career is almost done, but you go to the minors to fix it. Like, and then if you're Rick Ankiel, remember Rick?
Of course. Who could forget?
Well, you know, the great young left-handed prospect who just loses it, can't throw a strike, and he repackaged himself as an outfielder. So, you know, Carson Wentz isn't just going to become a tight end. So that's not a solution. More recently, Daniel Bard came back after losing it, but that was like 6 years later. So he's not going to wait 6 years before he comes back. I think the closest thing I remember in the NFL was Blake Bortles looked like he had the yips a little bit. And I don't want to just like, I'm not going to like thrust this on him. Like, I'm calling it a slump. When a guy's playing this poorly compared to the rest of his career baseline,
yeah,
it's a slump.
Right.
But there was a point where Bortles was just so, like, just lacking confidence. It was like it might have been the preseason that they actually went to the AFC Championship. It was 16 or 17. You know, he's like, his arm's moving slower. It's all, you could see him thinking. I think that's Wentz right now. The decision making is still, I mean, it's off enough that it's an issue. But to your point, even when he makes a good decision, footwork's off and all that stuff too. It reminds me a little bit of Baker Mayfield last year too. When you go yeah, back to the scouting report, and there's a list of positives and there's a list of negatives, and they all show up X amount of time. But this list of negatives for Wentz is just showing up way more. He's never been the most accurate quarterback. He's got one finish in the top 25 in our accuracy charting since entering the league, one. And it was that MVP caliber season of 2017. But now he's dead last, right?
Yeah.
And he used to offset the inaccuracy with big plays. And it's like, all right, you don't have to, you know, like a Cam Newton, like some other guys, you don't have to be the most accurate guy if you're making big plays. So it's just all off right now for Carson Wentz. So I don't know what they do.
He was never as good as MVP candidate Carson Wentz. Like,
right,
that was built on essentially foundations of sand in terms of insane numbers on third down or on, you know, long to go situations under pressure. Like, all of the most volatile, unstable, unpredictive data points we track, he was always going to be worse than that player. On the other hand, he's significantly better than the guy that's playing right now. Like, the guy that's playing right now is one of the worst starting quarterbacks in the NFL. And whatever you thought about Wentz before, he was better than that. So the question is, how do you get from where he is right now to being back to splitting the difference between awful and MVP? Because that's where he belongs somewhere. But the problem is, because he's in this kind of slump or the yips or whatever it is, I honestly don't know how you get back there. I don't think that just like, well, we're done with Wentz now, it's time to put in Jalen Hurts is the solution.
No. I mean, look, if you really decided, and this teams don't do this, right? Because you only have one starting quarterback. If you really decided he needs a mental break, he needs a week off, like, we're legitimately, and you don't do this because there's only 16 games.
Exactly.
Right? It's not like 162 game baseball schedule, 82 NBA games. It's not like that. But what if they actually did put Jalen Hurts in for a game and it's like, here's the decision?
I honestly think that might be the only way of doing it.
Now, doing that in Philadelphia with the media scrutiny and all that stuff, but Jalen Hurts goes in, no matter how he plays,
yeah,
it's a huge story. But I wonder, like, Carson Wentz playing well, is that's what the Eagles need. So what is on the table for that to happen? On the other hand, you could just say, look, this is so far below his baseline. Mm-hmm. We're going to play the percentages here. Slumps end, and at some point he'll snap out of it.
Yeah.
And I know that's not like the that's not like the sports take or the sports way to do it, but it's kind of the reality. Like at some point you have to positively regress, right?
I will say though, their schedule upcoming, 49ers next. Okay. The next two after that, Steelers, Ravens. If he has two stinking games against the 49ers and then the Steelers, I would think about sitting him down against Baltimore,
yeah,
throwing Hurts out there as a sacrificial lamb and saying, look, you're going to get murdered. Unlucky. On the other hand, it's more important to this franchise right now that Carson Wentz doesn't get murdered against the Ravens and what they do on defense. We're going to save him from that and hope he bounces back the next week against the Giants. Like, if you're going to do it, if you're going to press like a hard reset on Carson Wentz, that would be the week to do it.
Speaking of getting murdered.
Nice, nice, smooth.
Joe Burrow.
Mm-hmm.
Almost murdered multiple times.
Legally as well.
He's going to come out of this game. It's the highest graded game that he'll have in his career. And under crazy pressure, sacked 8 times. But Burrow continues to impress. And I think, you know, as an 0-2-1 Bengals fan back there, Mike, you know, have some hope for the future. I mean, Cincinnati, they're sitting there. Duke Tobin, who makes their personnel decisions, hopefully looking at all the free agent offensive linemen right now, all the draft offensive linemen. The guards were just a train wreck yesterday, an absolute train wreck for the Bengals. Jonah Williams, though, I still think will be okay, and he actually looked,
I think he's good,
pretty good. But you literally have one capable offensive lineman there, yeah, that you can trust week in, week out. And, you know, creep back toward average. How about just, like, don't get your quarterback killed? That's what we're looking for. So Burrow continues to impress despite the crazy amount of pressure that he's facing.
Offensive lines are about the weakest link. The problem is the Bengals have four weakest links. They have, yes, like, one link that's okay. One link that actually functions as a chain. And then the other four links that are just pieces. And Burrow is stuck behind that. He is when you consider how bad the offensive line in front of him is, we headed into the season saying, look, Burrow might be fantastic, but I don't know if you'll ever see it year one because that offensive line is that bad. It is. Like, the line is as bad as we thought it was, and yet we are seeing it. Like, that bodes extremely well for him if he can sort of survive the onslaught. You know what I mean? Like, as long as it doesn't become such a problem that 16 games of it starts to have that David Carr effect of, you know, just eventually it beats you down and you can't survive it. You might be able to get through it for 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, but by week 16, are you starting to, you know, run the hell away from it and bail on the way, you know, are you starting to lean into all the bad things that Baker Mayfield is doing right now, or have you survived?
Do you want a mulligan? Do you want a mulligan?
Do I want
on calling out the Carr family?
No,
please. David Carr, don't get the Carrs involved again here.
I just said, David, come on. If we can't accept that David Carr got broken by the weight of his offensive line, what were you doing here?
Yeah.
The man, he's the poster child, unfortunately for him.
76 sacks one year.
Right, of being beaten down by his circumstance. It's not his fault.
Yeah. So again, it's not the idea of just getting injured for Burrow. It's the idea that you are, like, your pocket presence is going to change. Right. But again, 24 dropbacks under pressure yesterday. 85 grade on those plays. That's second best this week behind, of course, Ryan Fitzpatrick. Two big time throws. Yes, he did get sacked 8 times, but just impressed with what he's done in that situation. So another week of be encouraged, Bengals fans. You'll win a game soon.
Right. It's going to be a slow burn, but like I say, assuming Burrow survives this year, I think they're in great shape because he looks legit.
It's also one of those things, too. Like, we always say, like, get playmakers first. And I think they have, you know, T. Higgins emerging and Tyler Boyd and then, you know, AJ when he's healthy and all that stuff. Fine. But if the O-line is absolutely a disaster, you can't even get the ball to them. So I think they're close, but it is one of those years. They have to look like what Buffalo did a couple years ago with Josh Allen.
Yeah.
They grabbed like 4 free agents and drafted a couple. I mean, this is like, you have to bring 6 or 7 dudes into the mix next year for 4 spots. I mean, that's really how the Bengals need to do this offensive line-wise.
I think there's an argument that that's the right way of doing it, though, in terms of, look, it's better for him that he has places to go with the ball than it is that he's protected every snap. Like, if you're confident that he's the guy, I think you're better off giving him, like, a good picture to work from in terms of where to go with the ball than you are you're not going to get murdered behind this offensive line. On the other hand, you can stand there for 5 seconds and no one's going to be open.
That was, if we go back to 2016, that was Dak and Wentz, their rookie seasons. I remember Mike Renner making the point. Dak had an incredible offensive line and so much room to maneuver in the line. So you could see that comfort level. And Wentz, you know, he had a lot of good coming out of his rookie season, but he also had that just huge pocket to play with. It is interesting when you have the young guys behind either an elite offensive line versus having good playmakers. So it was a tie, Bengals and Eagles. Let's go to New England. The Las Vegas Raiders and the New England Patriots. The Patriots continue to win games. Week one, it was all run game and defense. Week two, they get into a shootout with the Seattle Seahawks, and they're back to what seems like the game the Patriots want to play, right? Which is a run-first attack, over 200 yards on the ground, over 80% of Cam Newton's passing yards. Well, he only had 160-something yards. Over 80% came after the catch. So it was another one of those conservative-type attacks. Defense played great again, and you know the Raiders were unable. Tough short week going across the country after Monday Night Football, but Raiders fall to 2-1. Tough to know if they were a legit 2-0. We'll still figure that out in the coming weeks. That was not an easy short week for them, though.
No, I'm kind of impressed by the Raiders' defense. I think it made sense for New England's offense to be able to stifle, or for New England's defense, rather, to be able to stifle the Raiders' offense. But I'm reasonably surprised that their defense was able to do the same kind of job against New England's offense.
Besides getting gashed for 200 yards.
Yeah, but it's the right way of getting gashed. You know what I mean? Unless you have an amazing defense, you can't stop everything.
It was one of the rare games where EPA per play was in favor of the rushing attack for New England. So they had positive EPA in the run game and really negative EPA in the pass game.
It's like the way the Patriots went out there and took away Darren Waller, right? Like he'd been their weapon on Monday night against the Saints. It's like, well, obviously, that's what Bill Belichick does. You roll into a game against him, you know for a fact the thing you want to do first and foremost is not going to be there. And he did a great job, I think, of taking that away. The Raiders essentially, I think, did the same thing, except it's not like, what is your primary weapon? Let's take that away. It's what way do we want to win this, or what thing do we want to beat us the least? So the last thing you want to do is let Cam Newton wind up, pass the ball over your head, hit Julian Edelman 50 yards downfield the way he just proved he could do against Seattle. So let's take away the pass game. Let's give up a little something in the run game. And overall, that's a more efficient way of playing. I think they did a pretty good job of that. It's just that they couldn't match it on the other side.
I was really impressed with Trayvon Mullen. He'll come out with a monster grade this week, broke up 4 passes, but it was also the way he did it. He was doing it in man coverage. They rotated to an inverted cover 2 where he had to play safety and broke up a pass. So Mullen played a great game. So yeah, it is weird to say a team that gave up 200 on the ground and 36 points weren't all on the defense. There was a strip sack in the end zone on Carr and all that stuff. I was more impressed with the Raiders defense maybe than I would have expected in this type of game. New England's defense played more of their type of game. Derek Carr got away with a couple bad passes, threw an absolute dime to Hunter Renfrow.
Dude, that was a beautiful pass.
That was beautiful.
Deep pass as well.
It was a deep pass by Derek Carr. He threw it well. Look at us.
Should I revise my Carr comments?
Yeah, go ahead.
We got carried away, right? It's not that
Hashtag Raider Nation.
It's not that Derek Carr doesn't know what he's doing. I was thinking about this, right? I think you can look at the way he approaches a deep ball two different ways. The point we were trying to make was a little bit facetious, but I don't know it's entirely without merit that I don't think that he approaches the deep ball the way a lot of other quarterbacks do, which is when it's there, we're targeting it every time, right? And when it's not there, we're not going to throw it. I think he approaches the deep pass as a premeditated gambit most of the time, right? It's like every now and again, I need to take a shot deep to back the defense off so that I can be an efficient quarterback the rest of the time. And he is like a really technically proficient quarterback and usually very efficient on the shorter stuff, which is why that, like all the stats that people pull up of the success of the offense and all that kind of stuff, it's why that stuff is as good as it is, despite the fact that he's a lousy deep passer of the ball. But every now and again, you see like the pass to Hunter Renfro. Like he can still make those throws. He can still take that shot if you're going to give it to him. But I think most of the time, his deep shots are not like a reaction to what a defense is showing him. It's a premeditated gamble or premeditated tactical ploy that I need to actually take a shot deep. Otherwise, the defense is going to clamp down and I'm going to get like the Drew Brees defense, right? Which is everybody sitting at 7 yards and I don't have any space to work from. I need to actually back them off with a deep attack. Otherwise, that's what I'm going to be seeing every week.
Yeah, I mean, I've said before too, like I viewed him differently too. I said when he does, it was like Alex Smith a few years ago. When he does throw deep, he's actually pretty good at it. Now, are you good at it because it's calculated and you right. don't take tight window attempts or whatever it might be? But that was like my call to action this offseason was be more aggressive because you're good at it, because you do have great touch and you have the zip and all that. You know, he's got good arm talent. He's not, you know, the most talented arm in the league, like some might think, but he's got the talent to throw the ball down the field. So I want to see more of that, especially in games where you know you have to score a lot of points. You know, there are certain games like that, and you can't just scheme it up and create yards after the catch and all that. So
yeah, my overall overriding point that I was making was that I think there's something missing from Derek Carr that is there with like the great quarterbacks, right?
Yeah.
And you see it manifest itself in a bunch of different ways. I think the same thing is true with Kirk Cousins, that when things go in a slightly different way, the way you were planning them, that's when those great quarterbacks adjust what they do and match the circumstance, right? And you still get great play regardless of what's going on. When things go south with Derek Carr and with Kirk Cousins, overall, not all the time, obviously, because both those guys are capable of great play in a small and a larger sample size, i.e. like a whole game. But usually when circumstance changes and they're put in a more disadvantageous situation, those guys don't respond the same way. Like there's a perfect, I wrote an article about this in the offseason. There's a perfect graph that's like your aggressiveness deep down the field or in terms of average depth of target should change depending on down and distance, right? Because right. obviously if it's 3rd and 3, you're going to be targeting a different place on the field than if it's 1st and 10 or 1st and 20. But with Carr, it kind of doesn't. It's like a flat line. He's like the passing embodiment of that running back where, you know, if it's 1st and 10, I'll get you 4 yards. And if it's 3rd and 1, I'll get you 4 yards. Like right. no matter what the situation is, that's what I'm going to get you. Carr's like that, but from a passing point of view. And Cousins is a little bit similar to that as well. Like those guys don't change the way the circumstances dictate they should. And I think that's part of that. There's something there that is there with these great quarterbacks that is somehow missing with a Derek Carr or a Kirk Cousins. It doesn't mean they're bad players. It just means they're never, I don't think, going to get to that level.
And that's why that we have them as tier 3 quarterbacks, at least I do. And I think that is why there are certain offensive coordinators who take that guy and they can call plays to get the best out of that guy. Because, yeah. again, the ultimate goal is to have an efficient passing attack, whatever that. And the Raiders have had that through 2 weeks mm-hmm. until this week, right? They had an efficient passing attack, and they were still okay yesterday. It was a tough one against New England. My call to Carr or Cousins, well, Carr specifically is more aggressiveness. Cousins is aggressive because he's got a structure that calls a whole bunch of deep shots.
The good thing about that is, if I'm right, like if his approach to the deep ball is a premeditated, calculated, tactical gamble every now and again, that should be the easiest thing in the world to scale up, right? Because he's not reacting anyway. Like if it's premeditated, it's deliberate. All you need to do is say, well, instead of doing that once every 10 plays, do it twice every 10 plays. You know what I mean? It should yeah. be the easiest thing in the world to fix if that is the problem.
So there's another, another feather in the cap for Henry Ruggs. 2 weeks, high EPA, he's, leading this incredible offense, and then he doesn't play, and there you go.
That's not as good.
They're not as good. Right. Henry Ruggs, when on the field, is a game changer. All right, let's go to one of the craziest games of the week, the Los Angeles Rams at the Buffalo Bills. The Bills pull it off again, up 28-3. It looks like it's going to be a Houston Oilers-like collapse, an Atlanta Falcons-like
collapse. They blew it,
but Buffalo came back. And let's just start at the top. Credit to Josh Allen, one of the best games that he's played. And also, because I had to explain in a nuanced article with The Athletic, Matthew Fairbairn.
I read that. That was a good piece.
Thank you.
I mean, not because of you, but
well, he reached out to me, Matthew. Well, he took all my quotes and made them good.
Right.
He reached out to me and said, "Look, Bills fans are angry. Mm. They're creating T-shirts."
Yeah. Did you get one? I got a T-shirt.
Did you really?
It's on the way.
I didn't know, dude. It's like when you're a starting quarterback in the NFL. If you're not named Carr, you ignore the noise.
Okay.
You don't. You know, or Big Ben. I think those are the only two guys that listen to them.
It wasn't him, apparently.
I guess some guys don't ignore the noise.
Big Ben, apparently, wasn't him. It was like whoever was running his social was
just Darren
blocking
Carr
everybody.
For the Carr family. I know that,
right.
Too.
Well, it's at least a Carr. But it's with Big Ben, cars. Allegedly, it was just a person in his employ.
My point is I ignore the noise. I'm ignoring a lot of the criticism that we have because I believe in what we do in the in our system. But I do find it hilarious. Like Josh Allen's going to have a game where his stats aren't good, and we're going to be like, dude, that's an 85. He played great.
Mm.
Like at some point, we're going to be on the other side.
Right. It's going to happen
eventually. Right? But yesterday was almost – I mean, he played a really clean game until the fourth quarter, and it did – and then it became kind of like the full Josh Allen experience with a fumble and a lateral out of bounds or, all that stuff. But, again, from a passing standpoint, accuracy is much improved. He's in the top 10 right now this year. I'm impressed with his touch. And then, again, because he's improved that stuff from the pocket, all the freak plays are now icing on the cake. They're not the cake. That's the big difference for Josh Allen. It used to be everything's bad within structure, and then outside of structure, it's like, oh, look at this high-end stuff. That's kind of reversed because he's winning from the pocket now with this nice system, nice group of receivers, and he's got these freak plays outside the pocket where it's like, man, I can't sack this guy. I can't take him down. That's what makes Buffalo. And I said before the season, with all those playmakers, plus Josh Allen, plus those running backs that are tough to tackle, they're one of the most difficult offenses to defend, and that's what they are.
Before we get into the whole thing, can I just say that Josh Allen is rapidly becoming my favorite player in the NFL to watch.
Yeah.
Whether you love him, hate him, think he's amazing, think he's bad, wherever you are on the Josh Allen spectrum of analysis, he's just hilarious to watch play. Like, he has some amazing plays at both ends of the spectrum in pretty much every game. And there are also plays that, like, no other quarterback in the NFL can make. Both in, like, again, in all areas, right?
Yeah.
From those absurd lasers that, like, the deep laser that nobody else really has because nobody has that arm, to be able to, like, fire it in at a trajectory that never goes more than, like, 15 feet off the ground and actually connect on those is nuts. The idea of like stiff arming two defenders and getting flagged for the face mask because you just like grab the linebacker by the face and toss him to the side. Like he is just amazing to watch. He's also, as you know, rugby, the rugby aficionado on this podcast, that dude will attempt an offload in the tackle like nobody else in the NFL.
Will he? I mean,
and that
will
is
he?
Amazing to see.
We're now 1-1 rugby versus baseball references.
Exactly.
I may have had two actually, so catch up.
So he's just so much fun to watch, and now he's actually teaming it with, like, good play. Like, he was always kind of fun to watch, right? But it was sort of car crash TV that he's going to make a ton of plays, and some of these are going to be bad, and it's going to be pretty, like, you can't look away. But now, like, he's making so many good plays. The rest of the team around him is so good. Like, the Bills are a contender.
Oh, they absolutely are.
And he's not just a passenger. Like, he's part of them being a contender.
Yeah, he played a really good game. Part of the narrative this coming in too was like the Bills were coming in after three straight years of having a top 10 defense, particularly in coverage. And that's what I wanted to bring up. It goes back to this idea that defense is really unstable and it's really difficult. I mean, their defense, like they've changed the way they play, right? Last year it was let's get to 20 and trust our defense, right? We'll get to 20 points. Now they're dictating the action with the passing game. Like, they are comfortable playing in shootouts. And it's the right strategy because you can't just rely on your defense to be good. And now they're giving it up a lot more from a coverage standpoint. Levi Wallace, the only guy really with a good game yesterday. The secondary is not the same as they've been in previous years. Tre'Davious White's still really good. But, once again, it's tough to stop people in the NFL and rely on that back seven. And so it's kind of changed the complexion of the team. I think they're going to be that defense that's going to put together some good games. They're capable, but they're really comfortable playing in these shootouts.
Levi Wallace might be my favorite underdog story in the NFL. Like I just love – he's – I don't know how good he's ever going to be, but I do think there's a consistent chance that every year they're going to try and take his job away with like competition, and he's going to win more of those competitions than he loses.
Yeah.
But he's just, I love when he has a good game because I just think he's a fantastic story. But overall, this Bills team, I think, is a legit contender, not just like heading into the season, there was a lot of, well, look, the Patriots aren't the Patriots anymore, so you're probably going to take the division by default. And then, you know, who knows how far you're going to go from there. But they are putting themselves legitimately in contention to be not just a playoff team, but they're going to scare some people.
Well, here's the deal. We're going to learn a lot about the Bills. They still have to play the Patriots twice, obviously.
Yep.
They got to play the 49ers. They have to play the Seahawks. It's going to be an MVP battle between Josh Allen and Russell
Wilson.
It's
not an easy schedule.
Right. So there's still a lot to learn there. With the Rams, I was joking in our Slack chat. I was like, Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp are making the comeback here. The Rams have just their defense was bad on the other end, right? But they've just done such a good job of taking those two receivers, guys who get open. Their offense just feels like it's just so calculated and protecting of Goff this year. I just saw this. Did you see the stat Timo dropped in our chat?
No. What did you draw?
Every under center drop back for Jared Goff this year, play action.
Every under
center. If I read that right, I'll have to check that. It is a play action driven offense. We know that, but it just feels very protected for Goff. Plus Woods and Cooper Kupp getting open. They're just doing a good job of creating offense. It wasn't enough in this one with the Bills. I thought the Rams defense, they regressed back into what we may have thought. I mean, I was impressed with their first couple weeks, but again, how much was going up against the Eagles? They played pretty well against the Cowboys, but you're still like an offensive pass interference away from blowing that game. So I think there's still a lot more to learn about the Rams here.
Yeah, I do think that the fact that they executed some comeback was encouraging. I mean, there was a period in that game where they were just getting their ass kicked top to bottom, like everywhere they were losing. And, you know, it was a tough situation in terms of back-to-back East Coast games for a West Coast team, all those kinds of things. So if they had gone there, just gotten beaten up by the Bills, it wouldn't have been, you know, the worst thing in the world. It would have been understandable, but it would have been a pretty severe blow to their credentials as like a top-end team. But the fact that they did execute that comeback, get it all the way back, even late in the game, the final game-winning drive, you can say, well, they had that one up until the questionable, should we say, pass interference call. You know, they're very close to winning that game, which I think is a good thing against what we're saying is a very good Buffalo team. Also, like Aaron Donald had been really quiet for like six quarters of football and then suddenly...
Then tried to take over.
Right. Suddenly it's like, oh, okay. Aaron Donald's still there.
Yeah.
Like he's still good.
Yeah. He still ended up with a monster grade, eight pressures, a bunch of other wins. So yeah, he was a big part of that comeback. Impressive win for the Buffalo Bills and Josh Allen. Hashtag Bills Mafia.
I'm coming around on the Josh Allen thing. If he continues to play like this throughout the entire season, are we going to have to grow like patchy mustaches and stuff as tribute?
I'm not tributing. I'm not giving any sort of tribute.
No.
But look, the thing I said is I think he's going to have a season where he has a million touchdowns. It's 28 and 10. Right? He's going to have one of those seasons. Okay. Now I thought it would coincide with a completion percentage of like 58, 59, 60. That's part of the difference right
the
now.
The most impressive thing about him is it's this idea of consistent, steady growth, right? This is the weird thing, right? We get tagged as being Bill or Josh Allen haters, and yet pretty much from the get-go, you and I have both said that, look, there's a way this guy's successful in the NFL. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility. It's just like a small enough percentage that we wouldn't have drafted him seventh overall or wherever they picked him, right? He was a bigger gamble than that. But they've done a great job of like making that gamble pay off in terms of surrounding him with the talent and fostering what he does well. But what's amazing is what I figured is if it was going to pan out, it would be like all or nothing, right? It would happen immediately. It's like, wow, Josh Allen is way better than people expected. And he's just taking the league over. But it's been this steady, incremental, step-by-step growth development. Oh, I'm not great at this thing. Well, let's get a bit better at this. And then next time I'll move on to this. And he's just been like ticking off the things that he's been struggling with piece by piece by piece and becoming just this steadily better quarterback over time.
I want to get to this Washington football team, Cleveland Browns game. And I think the transition there is when you're looking at first round quarterbacks, do we need to change what we're thinking about? Because we've talked about, well, accuracy doesn't improve and blah, 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 blah. Have we focused too much on, so say, Dwayne Haskins? Dwayne Haskins, I compared to Josh Rosen coming out. I was like, he's worth a shot in the first round because so many quarterbacks are, to be honest,
right?
Because there's a potential payout there. But I don't feel good about Haskins because I just don't think he's a playmaker. I just don't see him winning outside of structure. And even though that's a small percentage of the plays, it's kind of like where's your floor, right? So Kyler Murray's floor is his rushing ability, because you, even when he slumps as a passer, he can run, right?
Great example this week.
Exactly. Patrick Mahomes' floor was the outside of structure. He'll still create some special plays. That's Josh Allen's floor, was he could go 13 for 30 in a game when he was completely inaccurate, but by the way, he'll maybe drop a few incredible plays in there too. The floor for Haskins or Josh Rosen is really low, because if the in-pocket stuff isn't good, there's no outside of structure. Like, yeah. So that would be – so I'm wondering if too many people – and people have said this before – there are too many people chasing Tom Brady and Drew Brees in that style, which is like those guys are at just a whole different level of decision-making and accuracy, and they do have natural playmaking ability. It just doesn't look as athletic as others. In other words, like, do you need a crazy playmaking athletic quarterback? All this to say, Dwayne Haskins was bad again for Washington, and I think there should be some concerns there, because, like, where do you go from here?
I think the best quarterbacks in the NFL shape the perception of what the prototype is, right? So when I dove back into the archives to do the research for the Montana Young episode, and you're watching all these old games from the 80s, and when you're hearing about, like, the prototype quarterbacks back then were not statuesque pocket passers. They weren't the Peyton Mannings, the Tom Brady's of the world. They were looking for these guys like Montana, like Young, like Elway, all these guys that could move and scare people with their legs, right? It's like, well, yeah, great if they can be a pocket passer, but the thing that really scares defenses is when those guys take off scrambling,
right?
And that was, and this was, you know, Montana, like these guys that were sort of kind of athletic, but not really. Those were like the prototype, right? Then you get this run of the Peyton Mannings, the Tom Brady's, the Drew Bledsoe's, these Troy Aikman's, these statue guys that don't move at all, Dan Marino, right? Stand in the pocket, deliver. And that became the thing that you're chasing. And then now you get
Dan Fouts.
Right. But then it swings back, right? You get Aaron Rodgers, you get, the new breed of Mahomes, of Lamar, of Kyler. And now it's back to being, well, you know what? Like pocket passers is great, but what if they can run as well? So my point is
just an ebb and flow of the NFL.
I just think the guys at the top skew perception towards them in terms of this is what you should chase and try and replicate.
But this also goes back to the fact that, like, back in 1985, there was like there was literally like 10 to 15 300 pounders in the NFL, right? So the evolution of the athlete, where you have not Cam Newton still at a special world, but like Trevor Lawrence is going to come out next year. Like, he runs the ball. He runs pretty well. Joe Burrow runs.
Well, that's why
almost every QB coming out right now at least runs well.
Yeah.
Minus Jameis.
That's why the sort of, you're essentially chasing the same thing as the 80s. It's just that the caliber of athlete necessary to achieve that is different.
Yeah,
like Joe Montana level athlete doesn't move the needle anymore. Kyler Murray level athlete does.
And I think that's going to make teams look, a guy like Dwayne Haskins is not athletic. And again, I don't think he has natural playmaking ability. So he needs to be pristine from the pocket.
Yeah.
He's got to be at, like, you think he's going to be top 5 to 10 accuracy wise. And my Sam Bradford comp for him coming out was like, everything's got to be perfect. Like, if everything's perfect, and I know we say that about a lot of guys, but if everything's perfect, Haskins can deliver and blah, blah, blah. But now it isn't at all. And so that's the other question. Now, Washington's situation is not close to perfect.
No.
We're going to talk about the Jets briefly. Sam Darnold's situation is far less than perfect. So now when do you give up on these guys? But anyway, Cleveland wins this game. Every time Washington had a chance to maybe get back in it, a lot of turnover-worthy plays for Haskins.
And every time they turned the ball over, the Browns scored.
Like,
at one point, there was 3 turnovers, and the Browns had 21 points off them. Like, Haskins was giving them the game. He's frustrating because it's like it takes him 2 attempts to make every good play. Like, he'll miss, and then the next one he'll connect on it.
Yeah.
And then every one of those good plays is being offset by a bad turnover, right? So you're way behind the eight ball. Not only is it taking you 2 shots, to do everything good, but you're offsetting every good play with a bad one. So you're way behind 500. The more interesting thing to me for this game was Baker on the other side, right? Because heading into this game, this was, I think, a good middle ground between unworkable Baltimore Ravens defense and too good to be true Cincinnati Bengals defense in terms of figuring out whether he could fix himself.
Yeah.
And Washington's defensive front can bring enough pressure to make him uncomfortable. I think it did. And for all but like a couple of drives, I think he was back to being, he was closer to the Cincinnati Bengals Baker, which is reasonably poised in the pocket, fairly comfortable, didn't bail too much unless given like a real reason to, and was able to be accurate back there. There was like a couple of drives in the middle where for some reason he could, like ironically, just after Chase Young went down injured, he just completely relapsed into old Baker and was couldn't stay in a pocket to save his life. But overall, I would say that's another reasonably encouraging game for this notion of Baker can be salvaged and turned into, you know, a good quarterback again.
Yeah, they also, they protected him pretty well. I mean, again, Chase Young only 9 pass rushes. He did get shut out on those, but the Browns did a nice job of protecting as an offense. You know, the entire offense, there was only a handful of pressures and not the best performance by that Washington defensive front. We talked about them a lot. I mean, that was their only chance, I think, to have that dominant game up front, and they did not have that at all. Houston Texans at the Pittsburgh Steelers. Did this game fly under the radar a little bit yesterday in the 1 o'clock mix?
Yeah.
It was like, you know, Houston was supposed to be one of the best teams in the AFC. They run this gauntlet of all the best AFC teams to start. They're going to fall. But man, it was just a good back and forth battle. But I still think Houston's one of the best teams in the AFC. Like, they're still up there.
Are they the best winless team in NFL history after 3 weeks?
They have to be.
Right.
Remember, 2 years ago, I was talking about the Panthers being the worst 6-2 team in history. Every week, the Texans are the best 0-3 team in history. Well, the Washington football team of 1 year started 0-5 and then went to 5-5.
Yeah.
The Brad Johnson Washingtons. We'll see if Houston does something like that.
This, on our preview show, this was the game that was flying under the radar a little bit to me. Like, when we divided it up and we're like, the three that we'll give a little bit more time to up front and then everything else after that. And you were like, well, there's three clear games that are the best of the week. I thought this one had a shot, but the reason I backed off it is because I didn't think there was any way ultimately that Houston was going to be able to perform in the face of what Pittsburgh was going to throw at them from a defensive point of view. But A, they did, and B, Pittsburgh didn't throw everything they had at them from a defensive point of view, which was strange to me. Heading into this game, the Steelers led the NFL by a mile in terms of blitz rate. They were at 68% or something insane. The Ravens last year led the league with 55, and I think they were the only team above 45%. So 68, it was madness. But this game, they blitzed Deshaun Watson 24% of the time. They went from 68 through 2 weeks to 24 in this game. And I don't know why. Like, I understand that as an athletic quarterback, he can punish you every now and again. On the other hand, like, they also led the league in pressure rate with that blitz percentage. So it was working. Like, I find it hard to believe that if you'd thrown that volume of bodies and pressure at Deshaun Watson, he would have individually gashed you to the point where it wasn't a net win.
I feel like we've seen that with Belichick through the years, where he will, if he faces a rookie quarterback, he doesn't like to blitz by nature, Belichick, but like all of a sudden he'll go 50% in a game if it's like, this dude is a sitting duck, we're going to get him. I wonder how much of, and Pittsburgh is blitz happy by nature, that's what they do, but I wonder how much they just dialed it up even more.
Oh, I'm sure.
By going Daniel Jones in that offensive line and then Drew Lock plus Jeff Driscoll in week two. And I think you're right. I think a little bit of the mobility factor and all. But I think on film, it would have been like, man, the offensive line's not handling anything right now. Plus Watson holds onto the ball.
Yeah. Like, I think 68% was, like, that's not what they're going to be.
That's too high.
That's a high watermark because of what you just talked about. Daniel Jones and Jeff Driscoll and Drew Lock, right? On the other hand, the way that Houston has been struggling so far this season is Deshaun Watson holds onto the ball. The offensive line isn't great at protecting, and Watson isn't yet comfortable with where to go with the ball. Once things start to break down, he's under pressure because there's no new Compkins. All of those things get more difficult to deal with if they're blitzing you every play and throwing a ton of bodies at you.
Yeah.
So why would you? I just don't understand why they dialed it back, and they almost got punished for it. Like, they dialed it back, and suddenly Deshaun Watson looks way more like the guy we saw previously, and he's able to hit Will Fuller, and he's able to find places to go with the ball. and the Steelers were trailing for a lot of this game.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think the Steelers as a team have really high upside because in a one-game setting, I think the Ravens and the Chiefs can be challenged by this Steelers team. But the downfield passing attack, just not there. When Big Ben threw the ball over 8 yards, he was 4 for 15 for 56 yards. Most of his yards coming on the short stuff. He's still kind of getting back to form. You know, I think he's still got some of the nice plays. He's still missing throws like he did in 2018, the last time we saw him for a full season. Chase Claypool is becoming a legit playmaker. They're even getting him the ball in space, you know, for a 24-yard gain. But they're not consistent as a receiving core, right? So even right. Claypool, he did fumble on that one play, but they're coming together as a group. I think we might just see these ebbs and flows of the Steelers, you know, and their offensive performance on a weekly basis.
I don't know that Roethlisberger is ever going to get back to being the best version of Roethlisberger, but the upside with the Steelers was anything he is upside over where they were a year ago.
Like right.
They
had absolutely.
The worst quarterback situation in the NFL last year. So anything, like any level of Roethlisberger is better than that. And we're seeing that, right? Like it's just varying degrees of how much better he was than what was there a season ago. Plus, they've added, you know, Chase Claypool, and there were weapons there that weren't there a year ago. So I think the Steelers are still a really good team. I think they got a little bit lucky to get out of this the way they did, given the game plan. I just think they had an opportunity to really take it to Houston and cause them all kinds of problems and didn't, and they almost got punished for it.
My weekly concern with Texans, with their defensive front and getting any sort of pressure, and then their secondary, you know, the most important parts of your defense, still concerns with Houston.
JJ loses the battle of the Watts.
Yes, he does. 3 Watts out there.
3 Watts.
Right? So Pittsburgh, moving on. Look at them. Completely turning things around with Big Ben back. Tennessee Titans and the Minnesota Vikings. Looked like the Vikings were going to pull the upset.
Yeah.
You were wondering why the spread was so close. I told you the Vikings are better than people expected, than they felt.
There were 2 games this week. So every year there's a game where there is zero logical reason for it to go one way, like nothing, absolutely nothing. And it does, right? Like a team springs an upset that came from absolutely nowhere.
This isn't one of them.
This was one. And the Texans game was another one. It really was.
The Vikings are not like
when I asked
Trevor
you the question,
Lawrence bad.
When I asked you the question, where are Minnesota better than Tennessee? Like they're worse everywhere.
Because I said like Cousins can. If we're going to call Minshew tank-proof, like you can win games with Gardner Minshew, of course you can with Kirk Cousins.
I'm not saying that they were shooting for the number one overall pick or anything. I'm saying that there's no reason they should have been in this game. Like Tennessee was better across the board, and somehow they almost like. And one of the ways they did it is like this was one of those games where they're rattling off 7 yards a carry. Right, the run game doesn't matter right up until the point you're able to generate 7 yards a carry out of it. And then suddenly it's a problem. Like it's, you need to have a baseline of being able to stop it. And this was a Dalvin Cook game in terms of just some incredible plays left, right, and center where Dalvin's making something out of nothing and taking off for 30 yards.
Love that guy.
And suddenly Minnesota's in there. The other thing, obviously, was the emergence of Justin Jefferson.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Raises some pretty significant questions in terms of why was Olabisi Johnson the starter for the first 2 weeks?
He probably didn't know the playbook.
I don't care if he didn't know a single damn word in that playbook. If this was the level of talent differential between him and BC Johnson, they should have done what the New Orleans Saints did with Michael Thomas in year one and said, all you're doing is running slants and goes. Look at the quarterback before the play and he'll tell you which one. Like, that's all they should have done. Like, I don't care how much he didn't know. He's so much better than the guy he just replaced.
I've heard coaches talk about receivers, and they're like, I can't play this guy because he doesn't know where to line up.
Who cares?
He can't crack the safety when I run duo. I mean, this is some of the stuff that comes up.
Yeah.
And I get, like, you do need to line up in the right spot, but, like,
there's some people can help you do that.
Spend an extra 20 minutes after practice to work on where you line up.
But also, like,
discussing the plays.
There's usually another guy on the field who can help you. Like, back in the old amateur.
Get on the line of scrimmage. Right. All right.
The old amateur Irish League days, there's a guy in the huddle that can tell you where the hell to line up and what you're doing if you don't know what it is.
We now have one baseball, one rugby, one, what's the league?
The IAFL.
IAFL.
Yeah. I'm just saying, the idea that this guy doesn't know what he's doing enough to be out there on the field is a terrible excuse if he's a legit playmaker.
Anyway,
it might be a reason to, like, you know, If it's a long-term problem, sure. But like week two, week one of his NFL career, help him out.
They used him in a lot of the ways that he was used at LSU too, which was, okay, he's going to play in the slot. He's going to work the middle of the field. He's got a two-way go on a safety. That's where I really liked him. That's why I really wanted him to go to Green Bay, which, you know, Aaron Rodgers doesn't need receivers anyway, but
he probably wanted that too.
I liked it. Aaron Rodgers did want him in Green Bay. I love his nuanced route running in the middle of the field. And I thought they did a great job with that. He had just a monster game. Weird game for Cousins because you just got a negated pick six. I mean, you've got some weird stuff going on there, but also an incredible play out of structure for Kirk Cousins for a touchdown. That other touchdown to Rudolph where he just throws it as he's getting hit.
Kyle Rudolph does is catch absurd one-handed passes in the back of the end zone.
But just Cousins getting that off and putting it in a position for him to catch it was really impressive. Yeah. So, look, I think Minnesota's going to be – now we're talking about them like they're the – you know, like one of those like upstart teams that's going to lose a ton of games. Like they're going to be competitive every week, I think. I mean, they're not going to look as bad as they did the first 2 weeks. But
they were also helped by Ryan Tannehill going back to Miami. Ryan Tannehill.
We had a couple
literally just after we had said, you know, how surprising it is that Tannehill is closer to the guy from last year, the best quarterback in the NFL grading than he is Miami. I didn't see that coming. And then boom, straight back to like Adam Gase levels. Miami Tannehill. Not quite that bad, but like this was the worst we've seen Tannehill for a long time.
Three turnover-worthy plays. That interception that he threw to Harrison Smith. Tannehill, like when you watch Brady throw the ball or Tannehill, they don't zip it a lot of the time. It just feels like they have enough on it to get it there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that style, when you do underthrow one, it's like, what? Do you even have do you have an arm? Like what do you do? Like his underthrow was just bad.
Do you know what that looked
like?
The
interception.
That looked like the drill they run at the combine. You know, the DB drops into the center
run
of the
under
field,
this one.
Drops into the middle of the field, then goes to the sideline, and the ball will be lofted up there to a spot so that you can high point it and run down the sideline for the interception, the pick six, right? Harrison Smith was running that drill, and then ball's just like straight into his hands. It was literally exactly what that was.
Look, I think credit the Titans. They're surviving without A.J. Brown. They're doing a nice job. The Khalif Raymond program. Give me all the Khalif Raymonds in the world.
Play action shot to Khalif.
It's just he is the play action shot guy, and it works. So that's how the Titans created those chunk plays. Corey Davis can't do it. He's the high volume possession receiver. Get Khalif Raymond out there to create those chunk plays. I just love it. Just three deep shots. Just go get them. And you know it's a key part of their offense. I love when teams are doing that. So. Credit the Titans. They're winning without A.J. Brown, even without Tannehill playing at a high level.
Well, that's a big part of that surprise, right? That suddenly the Vikings are competitive when Tannehill goes back in the tank and looks completely different to the guy he's been for the rest of his Tennessee career, right? Like if Tannehill goes back to being that guy, the dynamic for Tennessee completely changes. They go back to being the team they were when Mariota was a starting quarterback, which is problematic.
All right, let's go to another crazy game. Because it's the Atlanta Falcons.
God.
And the Chicago Bears. Mitchell Trubisky gets benched. 2-0 starting quarterback Mitch Trubisky.
Yes.
Really quick. You might not like QB stats, QB win-loss records as a stat.
I don't.
But if you're going to keep them, at least do it the way baseball does wins. At least do that.
See.
So if he starts.
Yeah.
And he leaves the game and the Bears are winning.
Uh-huh.
And they continue to win. They don't lose the lead. He gets the win.
So what does he get for this game?
Right now, they literally just say, did you start?
Right now, he gets a win. What should he get in your world?
Well, it's called a no decision, Sam.
Okay.
He gets a no decision.
A nothing.
Right.
Right.
Nick Foles gets the win.
That makes sense.
Right.
Trubisky's thing. It feels like Trubisky should have a loss for this game. He was 16 points down when they benched him.
I don't know if you know science, but you can't have a loss if you win.
But he was losing.
He was. But that's like if I'm a pitcher I leave and I'm losing, and then my team takes the lead after I leave, it's called being off the hook. You're off the hook.
Right. But his participation in this game resulted in a loss. He was 16 points down when he was pulled from the game. Therefore, he lost the game.
I would argue that if he merely had the opportunity to play against the second half Falcons, he would probably lead the victory as well.
I don't think that's true.
The Falcons are just at an incredible level.
They are. This whole game was absurd. Like, there's a point in the second half where, like, was it the first touchdown of the comeback to Allen Robinson, where they throw him like a simple hitch, and there's two guys in the process of tackling him, and it's like, right, you pull, like, freeze frame it. Like, Robinson scores in this play. Like, it should have been dead and buried. But between that, the insane fumbles left, right, and center, the, like, contested dual possession touchdown slash interceptions, like, this was an absolutely ridiculous game. And it was insane how early on it was obvious that the Falcons were going to throw it away again.
So, and then here's the deal with Nick Foles, going back to all of the takes, right? Like, the story of his crew and his Hall of Fame bust for Nick Foles should be his arm with a defender just like smacking it, right? And then you just don't know where the ball's going to go.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick Foles, and this is, I compared him to Daniel Jones, like, nobody loves making throws while getting hit quite like Nick Foles.
Except Joe Flacco.
Well, he doesn't know, though, is the thing.
He doesn't know
he's getting hit.
I think they're both similar. I think they're both cut from the same cloth in terms of they're very samey type quarterbacks.
No, Flacco and Daniel Jones. I mean, Foles and Nick.
This
Daniel
is like
Jones.
Early Flacco, not the guy that we recently saw.
But Foles he is aggressive under pressure. And this is why for the Bears, you know, we talk about do you want upside or do you want consistency? Foles brings this upside. He brings, maybe even if it's not game to game like we've broken down before, the NFC Championship, the Super Bowl, out of this world, Nick Foles, but just throw for throw, you have that game-winning touchdown under pressure, arm getting hit. And like the best thing Nick Foles does, again, going back to arm strength, he doesn't have like a cannon for an arm, but he throws through contact really well and gets it to the point. Like, that's impressive. Now, sometimes he tries it, and again, it just pops up and the safety picks it off and whatever. But that's the upside the Bears might need that Trubisky doesn't bring them, even though Trubisky's played well the first couple weeks. That's that's why you get a Nick Foles, because the payoff could be great. It could be bad, but it could be great.
It's interesting because Matt Nagy has come out and said, like, hey, it was just a gut feel. We thought we should move to Nick, or we haven't made a decision going forward, but it will be, they're going to make the decision this week, and it's going to be a permanent one, right? So whatever they decide this week is the quarterback for the rest of the season. Now, I don't think there's any way you say that unless you're making a switch at quarterback.
Nagy took Trubisky out randomly for Chase Daniel and stuff.
Right.
He's done a couple of those things before.
But there's no way you say that, right, what we're doing from here on in is the permanent solution at quarterback unless you're actually changing it, right? Like, we're going to Foles and we're not going back. Like, Trubisky's done. It's game over. The interesting thing is, I think it's fair to finally write off the Trubisky thing. To be honest, I think it was fair before the season. And even though he's played well the first 2 weeks, like, honestly, look, we were saying the Falcons defense, minus their first-round rookie cornerback with the COVID protocol, that was the team to continue your role against, and you couldn't. Like, if you can't show up against that defense, forget it. You're done.
To be fair, though, if you just let Trubisky play in the second half against the Falcons, maybe things
But here's the thing, right? So I think it's perfectly fair to just pull him and say, your time starting is done. Forget it. You're over. The Foles thing, like, he is prepared to air it out and, you know, go YOLO passing in a way Trubisky clearly isn't. On the other hand, it's also, he's also helped by the situation he came into, right? You're 16 points down. What do you got to lose? Sling it around, right? Just start airing it out and see what happens. Like, I agree that Foles is unusually good in that scenario, right? There's few quarterbacks that are prepared to YOLO the ball around the way Nick Foles is. On the other hand, like, there are a few quarterbacks that get presented with a no-lose 16-point deficit where you can't, like, all you can do is win the game, right? If you lose, we were already losing and it's Trubisky's fault. If somehow you pull it out of the fire, you're the hero and you probably get the starting job from here on in. So he's massively helped by that. Like, overall for Chicago, it's this weird spot where they probably got better by moving to Foles. On the other hand, I don't know that they got good. Like, Foles has that high upside and he can pull a couple of those games out of the fire and potentially win a couple of them where he gets high-end upside. On the other hand, he's also going to throw a lot of bad passes around and fundamentally is probably not a very good quarterback. So you're still in this situation where, like, the roster is good, the system is good, the quarterback probably isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I just I think it'll be a bit of a roller coaster ride for Bears fans coming out. If it is Foles, I'll be fascinated to see that one.
But I think it's the right move. Like, if you go, like, I don't see how you can go back to Trubisky after.
No, I'm good with it because look, even if you land at 8, it's like we talk about with win probability and stuff like that. Like, you know, it doesn't matter if you lose by 20 or if you lose by 7. So if you're the Bears, it doesn't matter if you, I mean, it doesn't really matter if you go 6-10 or if you go 8-8. You're not making the playoffs. But with Foles, there's a chance, and I know they're 3-0 right now, but there's a chance you win 11, you win 12. I mean, there's a chance with Foles if all the high-end stuff is there and he can avoid some of those bad games. I think there'll be a bit of a roller coaster there, but the high upside is there. And when you are down, he's the guy you want kind of digging you out of it, even though Trubisky did it week one. Let's not overreact, but I think that's exactly what Foles is. Some turnover-worthy plays in there,
yeah.
Some big-time throws. It all adds up to a comeback win against the Falcons. I don't know what you do if you're the Falcons right now. I just don't know. There's just something there. The hypnotizer got him last week. Did Chris give credit to the hypnotizer to Good Morning Football instead of me?
Apparently, yeah.
Chris, are you listening right now? You heard about the hypnotizer here on the PFF NFL podcast.
I'm saying you need to find proof of that. For all we know, Good Morning Football with their 6 a.m. live.
No, they're 7 a.m. live, just as we were last week. I did not listen to Good Morning Football. All right.
Does that matter? Like, if you didn't, it doesn't matter if you.
I came up with this.
It doesn't matter if you both independently came up with it, if they beat you to it.
You think Kyle Brandt came up with the hypnotizer? He's the only one smart enough on that group that would come up with it.
Yeah, I'm Schrader, just saying.
Maybe.
If they got it out
okay,
live.
Probably would too.
If they got it out live before you did, it's fair.
All right. Somebody's going to have to go research and figure out. I came up with the hypnotizer.
Feels a lot like that should be you.
I could have been name dropped on Sunday Night Football.
I know.
And Chris went the wrong way. So I'm going to have, like, Chris. I need a name drop on Sunday Night Football.
I'm just saying, like, if you're going to be calling him out for getting it wrong, you should probably check.
I am pretty confident. I am at least 75% confident.
That's at least 25% less than you
that I came up with the hypnotizer last week.
Well, we've got, it's in an audio montage. I don't see Good Morning Football's montage.
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody else say it.
Right.
Except us. Hypnotizer. So, anyway, what do you do with the Falcons?
Well, so it seems like a lot of people, it seems like that's going to get blown up at some point, right? Like, this is heading in an ugly direction now.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the uglier direction it heads in from this point on, the better they are, right?
Do you have, yeah, do you have any concerns about Matt Ryan in general? His play declined last year. We talked a little bit about this need for athleticism and all that stuff, and you have a quarterback who's getting a little bit older. He's not losing it, but like, is his floor lower now because of what everybody else in the NFL is doing offensively?
I mean, remember, no Julio Jones in this game.
Yeah.
I don't think he played particularly badly right up until the point they had a shot at rescuing the comeback. They just lost. They just finally thrown away the lead, and then they got the ball back to answer, right. And that was the worst pass he made in the game. Like, that's not great. But overall, like, he wasn't the problem in this game. Of the many problems Atlanta had against Chicago, I don't think Matt Ryan ranked amongst the top of them right up until the point of that final play. I think there's a lot of problems with the Falcons right now, of which Matt Ryan is not one of them.
Fair. That's all right. I think there might be an article this week about potentially trying to trade for him. This would be an unprecedented move.
Yeah.
Like an actual franchise quarterback maybe on the go.
Also, I mean, who in the Falcons organization is going to do that?
Nobody, probably.
Like, if you work on the basis that many people there are probably not going to survive this season, like, who is on their way out the door okaying the trading away of their franchise quarterback?
When Brady was a free agent, I did bring up the idea of you have Matt Ryan, who is a great asset. You could flip him for multiple draft picks last offseason, flip him for multiple draft picks and sign Brady if you really wanted to. And it was an attractive situation for Brady with Julio and Calvin and all that stuff. I just wonder if, there might be a shakeup in Atlanta at some point. Next two games, let's go quick. San Francisco 49ers and the New York Giants, and then into the New York Jets and the Indianapolis Colts. With the 49ers and the Giants, my biggest takeaway, Kyle Shanahan, great job. Again, 7 different receivers had at least 20 receiving yards. And we're talking fullbacks and tight ends and receivers and Brandon Ayuk leading the way. And a depleted 49ers roster was supposed to, you know, give the Giants a chance and keep it close.
They got stomped by the 49ers backups, essentially.
And if it was a close game, we'd be sitting here and be like, it's the Niners backups and the cross-country flight, because that's our analysis. The cross-country flight, guys, you can't recover from that. And the Niners just absolutely dominated. And for like the third week in a row, Daniel Jones played well enough, like okay. He played fine. And there's just nothing to show for it. They just have no shot.
Can I use my tin cup analogy now?
Yeah, and that'll be our analysis on on this game.
Oh, perfect. Kyle Shanahan, when Nick Mullins or C.J. Beathard or a non-Jimmy Garoppolo quarterback is the guy he's stuck with, particularly when he's also down like a bunch of skill position guys as well, is like, you remember the movie Tin Cup, Kevin Costner, the golf thing?
Yeah.
When he played around with like gardening tools, right? And the driver was like a shovel and then the rake was his putter. That's Kyle Shanahan when he's dealing with those guys. Like, it's just, he's a Rembrandt. Like, he's so good at what he's doing. It doesn't matter what you give him in terms of tools to work with. He is going to eviscerate you anyway. So it's tin cup with his gardening tools. It's like, you know, painters that create art out of like coffee grounds or whatever. Like, I don't need to go spending hundreds of dollars on fancy paints. I'm going to use used coffee and create like a masterpiece. That's Kyle Shanahan right now.
The San Francisco gardening tools throw for over 300 yards.
Yep.
Nick Mullins completes 9 passes at 10 plus yards and 7 different receivers, 20 or more receiving yards. Impressive effort for the 49ers. The Giants continue to be bad at important areas of football.
Yes. I will say Nick Mullins is not a bad player. Like, he showed before. Now, it's very difficult to separate him from the tin cup Shanahan of just master, you know, maestro levels of coaching. But like, the drop-off between Jimmy Garoppolo and Nick Mullins is not massive.
No, I mean, he's another – look, I think the most impressive part – the reason why last year's Niners breakout wasn't crazy is just because the two previous years of Kyle Shanahan saw only 6 games of Jimmy Garoppolo, where most of his games were Brian Hoyer and C.J. Beathard. And then another year where Garoppolo got hurt, and it's C.J. Beathard and Nick Mullins, and the Niners continued to at least be competitive. And it's like, all right, Garoppolo's better than those guys.
Yeah.
He's not a tier one quarterback or anything. He's better than those guys. So once you get him, it's conceivable that you're going to be better. So he's made do with the Nick Mullins of the world before, and Mullins is a, you know, hits open dudes. That's what he does. Shanahan creates open dudes.
That's the thing, right? I think it's difficult because the end result is not dramatically worse, but I think Shanahan has to do a lot more work.
That's fair.
When Mullins is the quarterback, right? So it's like he might still shoot 70, but it's a hell of a lot harder when you're driving with a shovel and putting with a rake.
All right, that's a good analogy. We're dealing with. Look, you don't hit on every analogy, but that's a good one,
isn't it?
New York Jets, Indianapolis Colts. What a mess. Jets are. I feel bad for Sam Darnold because of who he had to throw to and all that stuff.
Yes,
the Braxton Berrioses of the world. I mean, it's just a Jets receiving core that we said had a wide range of outcomes is on the bottom end of those outcomes right now because of everybody being hurt.
Yeah.
And, you know, Darnold had that one, you know, spectacular play, and then everything else was not great. And Xavier Rhodes picking him off a couple times, just bad.
So that's the thing. We were talking about like the range of outcomes, essentially assuming in a default world that everybody's healthy. Like, the range of outcomes actually is even broader than we thought it was when you factor in the idea that everyone could get hurt at the same time as well. And that's what you're dealing with the Jets. Like, the Jets are just, right now, they're miserable. And Sam Darnold is playing miserably, but he's in this realm of, like, the guy has no shot, right? He is playing badly. He is part of the problem. On the other hand, even if he wasn't, it wouldn't make any difference because there's no way you could be successful given what he's dealing with right now. So you just, every now and again, you get this flash of like, hey, look, Sam Darnold's got some legit talent. And then at the same time, he's like tossing balls to Xavier Rhodes, making him look like, you know, Darrell Revis from 10 years ago. Like, the Jets are just depressing at the moment.
Yeah. We're talking about, like, what are you looking for in a quarterback? I thought Darnold had that because he has that baseline of outside the pocket plays and all that stuff. The issue has been the turnover-worthy plays and, you know, lack of accuracy that showed up in college, you know, being worse at the NFL level. Mekhi Becton continues to be really good. I mean, look, if you're rebuilding, you got a left tackle.
That's helpful. Yeah.
There you go. For the Colts, once again, I think they're really close to being 3-0. I think they're flying under the radar because Phillip Rivers is playing just, again, outside of a few throws, he's playing a pretty clean brand of football. He's being protected very well. And it's just, I think the Colts are going to be dangerous.
Yeah.
And they made some plays on defense. I know it's the Jets, and I know they haven't played the greatest schedule going up against the Jaguars, Vikings, and the Jets so far for the Colts. It's going to get tougher.
But that week one, I think, changed. That week one affected a lot of people's perception of the Colts.
Right. It's they lost to the Jaguars.
We thought this team would be really good, and they just struggled against the Jags, who everybody thought was the number one overall pick team.
Or that's the right perception, and then they ran into the Vikings and the Jets. But I think the Colts have the elements to at least to compete, as we expected. Really nice run by Jonathan Taylor on the goal line for his touchdown, for whatever that's worth. But yeah, I mean, Frank Gore getting 15 carries for the Jets. I mean, there's just nobody on the Jets that's a part of a winning formula from a receiving, coverage, pass rushing, the quarterback play. There's just an aging running back who gets the 3.5 yards that are in front of him every time.
God, it was, I mean, he is crawling his way, like, yard by painstaking yard up the all-time rankings. Nothing screamed Jets more than like Kalen Ballage coming into the game trying to hurdle a dude and almost breaking his hip. Like, this is just depressing. That's enough time in this game. Let's get to another.
Carolina game. Panthers and the Los Angeles Chargers. Kind of a weird game. But the Panthers, who could not create any pass rush coming in, they get strip sacks, they got a pick six. I mean, the Panthers started to make some plays defensively.
I don't understand that. Well, having the story that came out with Tyrod Taylor.
Tyrod.
The story that came out regarding how he is no longer the starting quarterback possibly shed some light on the situation. But like every year, the Chargers reach like week three and they don't have anybody left on the offensive line. It's just this wasteland of guys that might have been playing okay but are now injured. And everybody that comes off the bench is people that just shouldn't be in the NFL. So they've just got this sequence of terrible offensive linemen. Brian Bulaga goes down hurt. And now it's like the answer to all of your woes, if you're a defensive line, is to just play the Chargers. Derek Brown, back-to-back games in the 30s to begin his career, goes up against the Chargers offensive line. Suddenly, oh, there's Derek Brown from college. The same with the rest. Like, remember the first game, Jeffrey Simmons' debut for Tennessee after the knee injury comes in. Like a 92 grade because he was playing the Chargers. And then hasn't been that guy since.
Ooh, Simmons, he looked like a monster.
Right. But until this year, it hasn't been that guy since. It's just when you play the Chargers, your defensive line is a completely different proposition. And that's what we saw. Suddenly, if you give the Panthers defense some pass rush and some pressure, they're a viable team.
Yeah,
but most teams, that's not going to happen against because they don't have the Chargers offensive line.
The Panthers had 8 pressures or 9 pressures coming into the game.
Yeah.
We have 22 pressures charged to the Chargers alone, offensively, including 8 to Ryan Groy. Trey Pipkins had 6. I mean, it was just rough up front. So again, Justin, the narrative around Justin Herbert in the first week, oh, he's great. And I think everybody focused on the good stuff. He did some nice stuff in this game though, too. I mean, I think there's been more good than bad. Again, if you're just looking to the future and, you know, some that you can build around, he's got some accuracy issues still. He's going to miss some throws, but he looked a little bit better. Again, it's a Panthers defense that has not played well, but they were getting after him and he was hanging in there and making some plays.
Yeah. I mean, I think honestly, he played basically the same game as he did the week before.
Yeah.
It's just that the narrative is going to end up being different because of how it came about. They came so close to executing one of the best plays in NFL history to win that game at the end. Hook and ladder thing, it was there. Like if Eckler holds onto that ball, if the ball is in a more catchable spot, he catches that on the run and he is gone to the corner. Like
that's
they
like
are
your
not,
favorite.
They're not stopping that play.
Your favorite play in football.
I mean, it's not my favorite, but it changes everything, right?
Yeah.
If you execute one lateral that they're not expecting, it completely changes what's happening. Now that was like the timing of that was pretty that needed to be pretty exact for that to actually come off. Like it wasn't quite, remember the old Randy Moss one over his shoulder to Mo Williams or whatever it was?
Oh yeah.
Like he had some time to work that, you know, and even though he executed like falling back over his shoulder, there was a fairly significant delay between him catching the initial pass and being able to get offloaded to Mo Williams. This one needed to be like a catch offload to a guy running full speed the opposite direction almost immediately. Like it was playing with such fine margins, and ultimately the margins were too fine. They couldn't even... two of the best receivers in the NFL couldn't execute it at the same time. But man, we were so close to like one of the best plays ever.
Panthers kind of flipped the script with Robbie Anderson with an average depth of target of 4.4 and DJ Moore going for 19. I thought after week one, they were doing a nice job of scheming things up down the field for Robbie Anderson. I would kind of flip that if I'm the Panthers, let Robbie be the deep threat next time around. So Carolina gets their first win in the Teddy Bridgewater era. The Chargers have to go against the blitz-happy Bucs next week. So
this is the thing, right? So 2 weeks in, I think Herbert has played basically the same 2 weeks, and yet his own coach is still sort of saying, well, look, this guy's not ready. There's a reason he was a backup.
Yeah.
Tyrod Taylor's the starting quarterback. Do they put him back in?
I think because of what happened with Tyrod, you just got to like give him a shot. You have to at least give him like a token shot to go back
in. You don't get sued.
Kind of. So they did that in... if you were hurt in spring training,
wow, we are going way.
If you get hurt in spring training, they wait until you're cleared.
Yeah.
You go, and say they want to release you. But you can't get released if you're injured. So as soon as you're cleared one day and then you get released the next day. I mean, that's not just baseball. That's every sport. That's
NFL just does that, right? You
right.
Can't,
so,
like the injury settlement.
Yeah. So Tyrod's going to
come back as a starter.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
or you get him in as like the running back next to Herbert for the first play. It's like, see, he was healthy. He was good.
They're reaching the point where like the argument that Herbert isn't ready is losing a lot of credence quickly.
Like, no, he's ready to. And then you just hope for the Josh Allen path. It's like, all right, this, you know, his ball's all over the place right now. The accuracy's not there, but the high end plays are, and he's athletic, and we've got to cut down on some of the bad decisions. And, you know, and you stumble into, you know, high year, a really good year when you get those good playmakers to throw to. All right, the Bucs and the Broncos. This was a beatdown from the beginning. It was one of those where it's like the Bucs feel like they're still just kind of figuring out Brady and Arians and the system and who's doing what, and they were okay offensively, and then it was just Denver had no shot offensively on their side other than like a two-minute drill against soft coverage for Jeff Driscoll. He just couldn't hit open throws. He was under pressure like crazy. It was just a mismatch with Driscoll at, you know, going up against this Bucs D.
Yeah. The Jeff Driscoll thing was never going to work. This is why, like, you know, last week it was like, hey, it's kind of depressing. You had Drew Lock, now you're going to Jeff Driscoll. It's game over. And everyone's like, well, Driscoll played kind of well when he came in. He's like, yeah, but like, we know who Jeff Driscoll is. Like, yes. And you were out of your mind. Like, yes, he played okay.
I didn't say, like,
for the brief
let's
period,
build around Jeff Driscoll.
For the brief period of time, he came in relief. But the idea that was going to extend beyond that game was nuts.
My expectations for Jeff Driscoll are so low because I only saw him play one good game in the SEC in his career that if he played half decent in an NFL game, I would be surprised.
Even in a game in which he didn't play disastrously when he came in for an injured Drew Lock, he passed up multiple wide open people in the end zone on the same play to take a sack. Like the Jeff Driscoll thing was only ever going to end in ignominy, and that's what we've seen this week. It's just the inevitable conclusion of what was going to happen.
For Brady on the other side, this was probably the worst game he played out of the three, by far the best statistical game, but he missed a few throws, a couple in the end zone. He looked like his timing was just a little, well, his accuracy was off more than anything. He had Gronk open for a touchdown that he overthrew. He had Chris Godwin open for a touchdown that he missed.
Do you think that they deliberately started feeding Gronk this week after what came out? So it was like, hey, after 2 weeks, everyone's like, hey, Gronk has basically not been part of this offense at all. And, you know, as Gronk gets asked about it, he's like, hey, I just came here to block. Like, good soldier, Gronk fell on his sword, took the bullet, whatever you want to say. He was like, I'm just a blocking tight end. I don't need to be catching passes. Suddenly, Rob Gronkowski had 7 targets. You know, like that.
And
felt,
he should have had a touchdown in the end zone.
That felt a lot like, hey, we're screwing this guy. Let's get him some passes.
I think Gronk has that same thing the elite quarterbacks have, like Tom and Rodgers. Like, doubt me, Breeze. Like, doubt me. Go ahead, doubt me. Right. I think Gronk, just like in 2018, he clearly lost a step. Right.
Sure.
but it was Brady to Gronk that set up the game-winning touchdown in the Super Bowl. I think he's got a handful of plays where it's not he's old Gronk, but he's got that, you know, he's got those turbos just kind of like saved up. So if he really wants to get open, or, you know, I think he's got a few good plays saved up. And because of what happened, yeah, he had a, you know, a good game getting open and right. making some plays.
But a big part of it is just he got targets. Like, he had almost double the targets in this game alone than he had in the two games.
But he also looked combined. More crisp and all. I'm saying he looked more athletic for whatever it's worth, right? This week. And maybe, you know, Mark Schlereth, who nobody likes hog mollies more than Mark Schlereth in these games. You know, you could have four runs in the entire game and he's going to talk all day with hog mollies, moving stuff. But he made the point about football legs, right? Like, hadn't played football in a while. So did he look lethargic and slow in those first couple games just because it's a different world for him and he's going to start getting better as the year went on? Or did he just get motivated? I don't know. There's something to it.
He was still working on the WWE legs?
Yeah, he's on the WWE legs. That's completely different. Your ring legs are different from your hog molly football legs.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No, yeah.
Detroit Lions and Arizona Cardinals. Feels like these guys play every week in Arizona.
Does it?
No, they've played twice over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Stafford and Kyler. Kyler was all over the place with the good and the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Stafford was all over the place with the good and the bad stuff. He went full Cam Newton, I'm going to overthrow everybody, and then drops a ridiculous dime down the field, and Detroit gets the first win.
Yeah. How have you not led with, we had an Andy Isabella sighting. Two touchdowns.
Yes, Andy did a nice job.
One of which was a dime.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Kyler dropping it
beautiful
in.
Beautiful throw.
The other of which was a classic Russian pencil. Like, just run the out. Like, don't run up, dance in front of him, then run the out. Just run out.
He got open.
He did. And he got two open. Touchdowns. And he showed that, look, hey, maybe he's actually a useful part of this offense if you give him some targets.
Receivers do take a little time. Receivers generally take some time. It's tough for them to hit the ground running as rookies.
Well, particularly when they're not given any opportunity.
If Andy Isabella continues to emerge with DeAndre Hopkins and then Christian Kirk coming back and all that stuff, you've got a dangerous offense here. It's still dangerous, but Kyler's got to stop making bad decisions over the middle of the field.
Yeah, he made some rough throws in this game.
But yeah, I think this was all over the place because Stafford, you know, both quarterbacks kind of kept the other team in the game, right? I mean, outdid it with or brought things back in with big time throws. It was a highly volatile quarterback game.
It was. And it was a great example of what you were saying earlier, which is Kyler's floor is so high because even in this game where he's making some hideous throws, he's also just dominating on poor old Jeffrey Okuda. That dude, like,
I know,
doesn't start week one because of a hammy. Week two, he gets eviscerated by Devontae Adams and the rest of the Packers offense. Week three, he's got Kyler Murray dead to rights in the open field on a bootleg at the end zone, at the goal line. And Kyler just like hits him with this move. And I don't think he even touched him. I think Murray ran all the way around the outside of him. And I don't think he even got a finger on him. And people are like, oh, you know, tackling guys in the open field is hard for like, he did a good job. No, I'm sorry. He didn't. Like, it's a tough assignment. Kyler's a hell of an athlete, but ultimately he grasped at nothing and didn't even touch him on his way past him to the end zone. That's embarrassing. He did get one back later with an interception.
He did have an interception.
But he had another rough day at the office for a number three overall pick starting his NFL career.
Neither pass rush did much. And, you know, these teams came in with some question marks. We're only seeing a handful of snaps a game from Isaiah Simmons. And I don't know if, you know, he had 16 snaps in this game for the Cardinals. I don't know if it's like, let's be disappointed in Isaiah Simmons right now. But I think they expected more of an instant impact for their number 8 overall pick.
Sure. Do you think that, well, yeah, I agree with that. On the other hand, even in week one, he wasn't playing much. Like, he had 18 snaps, I think, week one.
Yeah, well, he got, like, week one was like, here, cover George Kittle.
So that's what I was going to ask, right?
Here, cover Mostert on the angle route touchdown for 75. I don't know if that was, like, confidence lost, because that's when he stopped playing, mostly in week one.
Well, they dialed it back last week. So what I was going to ask is, do you think that that's still shaping how much they're going to put him on the field? Because they didn't actually have him on the field much that week anyway, right? It's just that when he was out there, he might as well have had a bell on him because Kyle Shanahan was just going after
him. Yeah, that was not fair.
Week two, I think he only played like 7 snaps or 8 snaps or something. So they dialed it way back. And then this week, 16, which is, you know, 2 fewer than week one, but that was where he was, right? So it's not like he was ever this every down player. On the other hand, we've now seen that, like, when he's out there, the teams go after him.
What I think, because of the lack of preseason and the lack of reps, I think that hits everybody differently. Some rookies, it won't matter. Other rookies might need more time. I think we just need to not overreact. So please save your hot takes. No, but it really is like one of those, he might be fine,
yeah,
but they might just look at him like, dude, we got to get you on the practice field. Right. We actually have to get some reps. And by week eight, maybe he's a part of the game plan a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it's showing right now is that if you had high hopes for an immediate dominant playmaker who could change the way you were playing defense, that's not happening. It might still be like if he becomes a Pro Bowler in years two forward, it's still a sound decision. It's just that this adjustment is going to take some time.
Even Devin Bush for the Steelers last year, it's like, this is the missing piece of the defense. He graded in the 60s. He had his ups and downs. He was a rookie, and he was out there every single snap last year for Pittsburgh. So it takes time for some of these guys. The Lions are back on the board. I think I picked Arizona because I was lazy. But it just felt like one of those games where 0-2 Detroit is better than that, and 2-0 Arizona is not as good as that, and it would have been, felt like a Lions game.
I think, my analysis of this game heading into it was that Kyler was going to have a day against that man coverage, right? And in particular on the ground. Now, I think the man coverage, because Kyler made some pretty ugly decisions, like, they actually ended up, I guess, winning that encounter overall, or at least doing as good a job as you could expect it to, at which point that becomes a different game. And the fact that Detroit wins it is not like a massive shock.
All right, let's get to the two primetime games. Oh, wait, what am I talking about? Just because they're at the bottom of the schedule? It's early. The last 4 p.m. game to get to, the Dallas Cowboys and the Seattle Seahawks. As expected, a shootout, a crazy finish. You know, you talk about Derek Carr and him going deep and it needing to be calculated. The throw that Russell Wilson made to seal the deal, and they're supposed to, and I just love this, right? I love the aggressiveness by Seattle. They're in field goal range, but instead of just relying on a kicker, they run a bootleg on 2nd and 1, trying to pick up a first down, trying to get closer, even maybe trying to score a touchdown. And then on 3rd and 1, they pass again, and Russell Wilson, patient in the pocket, there's no pressure, and he throws flat-footed 40 yards in the air, hits DK Metcalf in stride. That was like the opposite of how you described Carr.
Yeah,
Carr needs a dialed-up shot.
Right.
Russell Wilson's going to hit a deep ball 4 seconds in the progression on his like fourth read and put it right on him. Like, those are game-changing plays.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that is the contrast to Derek Carr, right?
I stole your take.
Whereas, no, I mean, you just articulate it, right? Whereas Derek Carr it's a calculated, premeditated shot that I am going deep on this play unless you take it away from me specifically. Russell Wilson is the other end of that, right? Which is, he is going to take the deep shot if you present him with it, regardless of what the situation is. So, and we saw that last week, right? It was all they needed was the short first down to pick up. And instead they go for it all and it's inches out of the hand. Right.
Yeah.
It's inches out of DK Metcalf's hands. But the point is, if you show him that, he's going to take it, right? Because that overall, he's really good at that play, and those are so valuable. And in the greater scheme of things, you're going to win way more often doing that than you are not taking that shot if you present it to him, right? That's Russell Wilson. He's the other end of that spectrum, whereas regardless of what the situation is, he will take that deep shot if you present it with him, as contrasted with Carr, which is he's taking those calculated shots specifically unless you remove it from them. But most of the time, even when presented with them, he's shying away from those shots.
Before the season, we were talking about Brian Schottenheimer, the offensive coordinator for Seattle. We should pull up this soundbite. You were claiming he just doesn't know how to be aggressive. He just can't do it. He just can't help himself to create this offense around Russell Wilson. Well, he has. And not only has he's probably been one of the best play callers in the NFL. We'll see where our numbers end up. Because as great as Russell Wilson is, and Russell Wilson should have had 6 touchdowns on the stat sheet yesterday because DK just dropped one at the goal line, but they keep scheming up open throws on the goal line. Now, Russell's thrown 14 through 3 games, so of course there's going to be some easy ones in there. There's some luck, and then there's some great. But through 3 games, we're talking screens and wide open passes in the flat. Like, the NFL, if you just watch the NFL all day yesterday, can anybody cover the bootleg on the goal line? How many just wide open, easy touchdowns were there? This isn't a new play, but it's just wide open. Josh Allen had 2, and Rodgers had at least one. Wilson had two. I mean, it was just ridiculous, right? But Brian Schottenheimer's dialing up a good game. Not only like early down aggressiveness, but in the red zone, open throws. And it's really a mesh of Russell Wilson playing at an elite level and the rest of the scheme coming together that's making Seattle so different.
He's also showed how easy it is to make the adjustments that a lot of, you know, analytics people sort of cry about all the way through off seasons and stuff, right? It's why can't this team just be more aggressive and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, it's not as simple as that. Turns out a lot of the times it is. All you need to do is to slightly move the percentage of runs to pass plays on like first and 10.
You set your Madden slider.
Right.
That's just reset your Madden slider.
That's all Schottenheimer has really done is he's just changed how often they're letting Russ pass the ball on first down so that suddenly you're dealing with less second and long plays. And that leads to less third down, difficult to pick up third down, you know, third and medium, third and long, whatever. Like you just make, it makes everything easier because your first step was in the right direction, not necessarily the wrong direction. And you still have the run in there. Like they're still sprinkling in those run plays. It's not like you've gone 100% pass. You've just changed the ratios and that makes everything better.
We predicted a Big 12 type of game. This is really what it was. Russell Wilson dropped back 54 times. Dak, he dropped back 64 times. Just ridiculous. Dak had far more good than bad, but this felt like Dak with the Cowboys and their secondary who couldn't cover anybody. Said the same thing about Seattle coming into this week. Dak felt like Patrick Mahomes at Texas Tech. Like he had to be perfect, and he wasn't because there was a fumble in there, and then I was waiting, that last interception that he threw, man, I was waiting to see what was on the other end of that throw. He was about to get sacked, unbelievably keeps himself up, and I'm just like, I'm in my head, I'm thinking, all right, I'm about to watch the best play in NFL history. This is going to be spectacular. He's going to gather himself. There's going to be some dude wide open at the end of the, on the other end of this pass. And it was intercepted to end the game. And I don't blame Dak for that. I mean, it was like 14 seconds left. You got to throw one up. It's not like, oh, he choked. It's a game-ending interception. It was a spectacular effort to even get to that point. But it just felt like the Cowboys knew they had to get into a Big 12 game. They played it like it was a Big 12 game. They had to be perfect. And we're talking a couple turnovers away, really.
Yeah, it somehow felt like a little bit of a letdown in terms of the way to end that game, given what we'd seen from the rest of it.
Right.
Seattle got a little bit of a pass rush.
They did. That was my big takeaway.
Everybody
too.
Got hurt, so it made sense.
Yeah,
in terms of Dallas's offensive line,
and this is why we don't want to overreact. Like through 2 weeks, Seattle's pass rush horrible, almost nothing, other than Jamal Adams. Same thing with the Panthers. And you know, week three, the Panthers showed up, and then Seattle showed up. Now Dallas's offensive line, you know, playing rookies and just not where they have been in the past. But Seattle got some contribution from unexpected places, which was huge for them. They needed it.
Zach Martin, guard, ends up having to kick out and play 39 snaps at right tackle and plays pretty well. He's a great example of this idea that we, every time at draft time, why not give him a shot at tackle before you make him into a guard? That's not like you can say it was the wrong decision for Dallas because the guy's been a perennial All-Pro.
Right.
But it does raise the question of, like, what would he have been at tackle? Like, would he also be a perennial All-Pro at tackle and therefore a more valuable player for you?
Possibly.
Yeah, and he never got the opportunity to take a shot at that because you immediately moved him inside the guard. But this guy was a good college tackle who, it turns out, can be a good NFL tackle when all your guys on the offensive line get injured and you have to reshuffle.
Seattle wasn't necessarily good rushing the passer because they had 64 opportunities.
Yeah.
So when better because they did get there. And I think more importantly, they just got there at key times, right? They got there at the right time. They forced the strip sack and all that. That Dak could have held the ball a touch long on the strip sack and all that. But they got some key plays. I still don't trust the Seahawks getting after the quarterback consistently without Jamal Adams rushing again. And third straight game, Jamal Adams got after the quarterback, rushed at least 10 times, 13 in this one. Yeah, it was 64 attempts, but
wasn't as effective in this one, though.
He was not as effective. And then Alden Smith with three sacks, who's the only guy that actually performed well on the defensive line for the Cowboys. That's the other part. Seattle is doing a better job, I think, of protecting Wilson. So he's got better pockets to work with as well than we're used to seeing.
Alden Smith is turning into quite the fun redemption story. When we talked about this in the offseason, like, what does 5 years out of the game do for you? Yeah. Does that save you 5 years of wear and tear? Does it mean that you're so hopelessly out of like football shape or football just life that you're never going to get anywhere near back to the player you were? And then with him, you always had the complicating factor of like that dude was battling some stuff while he was in the NFL the first time around. Like, he was a really good player, but like, how much better could he have been if he'd been clean and sober and not battling personal demons the whole way?
Yeah.
That guy could have been like the best player of his generation, and we never got to see him at that level because of that. Like, what happens if you just take that out of the equation? If you just take the fact that now he's clean and sober, even though he's over 30 now, like, there was this whole unknown. I mean, he's not an all-pro or anything yet, but he's a hell of an addition to pick up out of nothing, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he'll be huge for the Cowboys down the stretch. It's just been such a weird start to the year for Dallas, right? I mean, they lose to the Rams. It wasn't much of a shootout. And then they get into these shootout situations with the Falcons and with the Seahawks. It's a pass-heavy attack. There's key fourth down decisions. A lot of stuff has shaped the Cowboys season so far. And all that said, they're still in really good shape to win the NFC East. Like, I still feel good about the Cowboys winning the NFC East.
Yeah.
At 1-2.
But it's sort of like last year where it's like somebody's going to crawl over the finish line in first place.
I thought the Eagles would be better, obviously.
Yeah.
And they're 0-2-1. So the first place, 1-2 Cowboys.
Yes. And that's why I agree with you. That I think
WFT.
You can feel good about them winning the division, but it's way more now about the fact that that division, it looks as winnable as it was last year in terms of someone is going to stumble over the finish line in first place.
But it's also going to be the same thing. If 8-8 Dallas gets into the playoffs, you don't want to play 8-8 Dallas. You don't want to play that team because they have a Dak and a passing game that can wreck you in a given week.
I would say that they're more dangerous this year than they were a season ago, particularly if they do get healthy on the offensive line.
Yeah.
Like, this is they lost everybody. I mean, they had guards kicking out the tackles, guys that have no business starting, being on the field. Like, this was a bad offensive line, like one of the worst in the NFL. And again, if they just get back towards average, forget the stable of all pros, if they just get to a viable offensive line late in the year when they get healthy people back, then it's a completely different proposition. And they were still like, they've still scored points with the terrible offensive line. Like,
right.
This has potential to be really good.
All right, let's get to the last game of the week. Green Bay Packers remain undefeated, beating the New Orleans Saints 37-30. A back and forth game. Rodgers versus Breeze. It was a cool one. It was good. Man, Rodgers just no Devontae Adams. And maybe we've underrated this part of Rodgers the last couple of years because we've talked about he doesn't have playmakers and this and that. But when Adams is out there, he feeds him like 15 targets. Rodgers' best game last year was against the Raiders without Devontae, and he spread the ball around and he was great. That's what this game felt like. He just gets his boy, Allen Lazard, who maybe we're just not giving Lazard enough credit. Like, he's got size and, you know, sneaky speed.
Sneaky 4.8 speed.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. Rodgers and LaFleur out of the boss, Chris Collinsworth, talked about their offseason, just getting on the same page, finding the plays they liked. And I think that's coming through here.
I mean, this is week three of the Aaron Rodgers revenge tour in full swing. He is cooking at this level. Like, he is MVP Aaron Rodgers again. And what's really amazing, so he gets credit for like the plays that he makes, you know, the spectacular throws and all those kinds of things. Maybe the most impressive play in yesterday's game was the throw he didn't make to avoid the interception, right? Where they dialed up this insane blitz. They had the three guys at the line, and then Malcolm Jenkins was going to drop off from the far side of the line and drop under the slant to essentially take away the built-in hot route, right?
Yeah.
If you read blitz at the line of scrimmage, you have a designated hot route that's where you go with the ball to fill the gap that the blitz is coming from, right? The two guys rushing from that space are going to leave a vacated area and you're going to run right in there, immediate throw. They dropped a guy to fill that space from the other side of the offensive line, and Rodgers was able to see it and not pull the trigger on what was basically in the playbook. Like, if he'd made that throw, Jenkins had picked it off, pick six, he would not have been sort of criticized for that in the meeting room afterwards, right? It would have been, they just got us. That was a great play call. There was no way you could have seen that coming. Chalk it up to experience and move on. And that's the difference in this game. Like, instead of Taysom Hill fumbling and that being the decision, it's Rodgers throws a pick six that, you know, was just a great defensive call, and that's it. But we talk all the time about Rodgers' like conservative nature a little bit, and not, you know, eating some sacks rather than taking or making bad interceptions. But we probably don't talk enough about those plays. Like, he is absurdly good at reading a bad situation and getting out of it.
Right.
And he didn't just avoid throwing a pick six. He also then like turned to the other side of the field and got like 5 yards out of it. Like, he got a play out of that that could easily have been the difference in this game.
Yeah. For as many negative plays as he takes from a sack standpoint, he, again, if you start with this baseline of big time throws and turnover worthy plays, where Rodgers is always among the best in the league, high big time throws, low turnover worthy, then it's all the stuff in the middle. And that's the stuff that's been different. He's getting better at that right now, but not turning it over, not putting it in harm's way, and then finding a way to turn it into a positive play. He does that so many times throughout a game. Even just that pass to Mercedes Lewis.
Yeah.
You know, he's turning no plays. This is a play that is not schemed up. Nothing's open. And then he rolls out of the pocket and puts the ball where only Mercedes Lewis can push off and make a catch for a touchdown. I will say that drive, I do hate when that becomes the drive, right? That pass that he threw to Tyler Irvin, way overthrown. Tyler's like 5'8". That ball landed 10 yards out of bounds. It wasn't even like a thought. Like, I didn't even see refs talking about, wait, was it too high?
Yeah.
Like, it was clearly like contact, but I thought that was uncatchable.
My initial view of it was exactly where you were, which is like, that's an absurdly uncatchable pass to not throw pass interference or to throw pass interference on. The second angle where it was right down the sideline. So the ball landed basically just over the white line, right?
Yeah.
The white line is what, a yard wide? So it landed a full yard and 6 inches beyond the scope of the pit or the field. On the other hand, it came down with quite an arc, and like, a guy can jump pretty high straight up in the air. Just that angle made me think, maybe a guy jumping up, if he hadn't been interfered with, could have snagged that and come down in bounds. It was at least debatable enough that I was like, all right, I'm not gonna tweet about it and get like a world of people in my mentions going,
no, I know, because we do that all the time. We're like, if this didn't happen, this guy would be here. Yeah. How do we judge this? I get it.
But I think the later part of that drive, the fact that they like that was debatable, and then the push off from Mercedes Lewis was also debatable. It's like, all right, now you've gotten the benefit of two coin flips in your favor on the same drive, in addition to them giving you a ludicrous spot that they had to walk, or you had to challenge to get overturned. Right. And then later on, it almost seemed like they were trying to undo that one with the crazy touchdown, no touchdown spot. Like, that felt like a touchdown that they were trying not to give them. But yeah, it did. There was a run in that game where Green Bay was getting the rub of the green multiple times with officiating.
The dome would have been livid.
Yes.
Absolutely livid. The Packers, impressive.
But just again. So Rodgers, like Russell Wilson, the big thing with him is the crazy touchdown to interception, or the touchdowns, right? 14 touchdowns through 3 weeks. It's insane. It's like the most ever. Rodgers has more big time throws. Rodgers has 12 big time throws to Russell Wilson's 10, and neither guy has a turnover worthy play yet. So that idea that, look, Rodgers does not put the ball in harm's way, and he is probably the best player in the NFL at doing that. You can criticize that it comes at the cost of some sacks that he shouldn't take. But like I say, that play, and it's a play that he didn't make. The mistake that he didn't make in this game was arguably the single biggest play in it.
On the other side, the Saints offense, all through Alvin Kamara.
Yeah.
That last touchdown that he had, 60 plus yards, just absurd. Like, his balance.
You mean the 52-yard Drew Brees touchdown
52,
pass?
Yeah, 52, whatever. Yeah, 57 yards.
The Drew Brees touchdown pass?
Next Gen had expected 17 yards on that or something.
That was like, interesting.
But it was like, he got popped.
Immediately.
Right away.
Yeah.
And that's been the story of the Saints so far. That happened against Tampa Bay week one. Happened a little bit against the Raiders. Brees goes through progressions. He checks down. And then like, guys are getting hit. And it's like, all right, you're not going anywhere. That's happened a lot. And it looked like it was happening again, like a late check down. And then Kamara, man, just that balance and ability to just shrug off contact is unbelievable.
Yeah. Where are you on Drew Brees after this game? Because going into this, going into that game, we were saying, look, the Drew Brees through the first 2 weeks was not workable. And your pitch was, I'm not ready to write him off yet. We'll see how he does this week. My pitch was, if he does the same thing against the Packers, you now have decisions to make. So where are you coming out of that game?
He wasn't much better in this game.
Right. But on the other hand, so it's funny.
But they scored 30 points.
Yes.
So yes, it takes a spectacular play from Alvin Kamara and all that stuff, right? But I still have concerns with the downfield passing game, obviously. He had a fumble. There was some bad stuff in there. But how are teams not really putting like 10 dudes up inside the 5 yards and just daring him to make those plays? That's part of the thing. Will teams really adjust and really take away that stuff? And the reason why I said he could be successful is because he's still smart enough to go through progressions. He can, and if he throws the ball early enough, he can at least get it out there for guys to make play. And that's a lot of what we saw. Like Emmanuel Sanders is wide open. He just gets it out there early so you can adjust, make the play. Like some of those plays will happen. They can stumble into enough offense that they're not going to look like the Jets, but it's going to come down to, you're not going to see the seam routes you usually see. You're not going to see some of those special throws. That's going to limit you against the better team. So I think it's for winning a Super Bowl, they're limited, but they're still going to put up a good season with all this, you know, yak heavy offense.
And that's the critical point, right? Is it doesn't matter how bad it gets. Like this is not the standard for this team is not like average or good. The standard for this team is Super Bowl, right? This team is loaded up to win a Super Bowl to end the 2020 season. And Drew Brees can ride off into the sunset as a 2-time Super Bowl champion, Hall of Famer, right. And we get then have to deal with the salary cap hell that will ensue. But this team is trying to win a Super Bowl this year in a way no other team has tried to do before in terms of all in. So that they are still good is irrelevant. Are they good enough to win a Super Bowl playing against the best teams in the NFL? That's the standard, right? Now, I was actually a little bit more encouraged this week than I have been the first 2 weeks, because I saw a couple of passes in there where Drew Brees was prepared to fire it into a window with some zip a little bit further down the field. The two passes to end the first half, right? The touchdown and the one that just preceded it where they weren't on the same page, him and Jared Cook, I think was the target, but he fired it into the window and like it flashed straight past Jared Cook, like it was there. The fact that he A, had the arm to make those throws and B, was still prepared to pull the trigger on them, I think is encouraging. There was a couple of other plays in there as well. I haven't checked yet. I really want to see what the tape was what the tape shows in terms of they dialed up a couple of deep called attempts and he pulled the ball down both times and had to eat it. I want to see whether those were open, whether he talked himself out of it, whether it was viable or whether he just doesn't want to take those shots anymore. But the Drew Brees that played last night, it wasn't much better than we've seen the first 2 weeks, but I think it might be enough better that you can at least kick that conversation down the road a couple of weeks, right? There's enough of a difference between the guy we saw last night and the guy for the first two games that I don't think you have to talk about Jameis or Taysom Hill yet.
Here's the bottom line.
But it didn't like answer it. It wasn't like, forget it. The real Drew Brees is still here. That's never going to come up. Like that's still looming.
Using passer rating as a proxy for just like, here's this production and here's how 127.8 in part because of the 52 yarder.
Yeah.
A huge part because of the 52 yard, both Kamara touchdowns, right? And a great touchdown to Emmanuel Sanders. That was beautiful. Up and away from coverage. That was the best throw of the night, other than like velocity wise. I mean, that was the best throw and execution of the night for Brees. The fact that Sean Payton and Kamara and the playmakers can get that production out of essentially a 60-something grade from Brees, which is what he had. I mean, that is what bodes well for the Saints and their offense, right? And Brees will have some better games.
Sort of, though. Like, there was a good stretch of this game where it felt like a game plan you create for a young quarterback that you're protecting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It didn't feel like a game plan you run for a Hall of Famer that's like the all-time leading passer in the NFL.
Right.
Like this felt like Drew Brees suddenly being protected by the system, which is good because it means like you can put up a ton of points and the reason you lost was because the guy who comes in for gimmick plays fumbled it away, not because of anything Drew Brees did. Like you had a shot to beat the best or one of the best teams in the NFL playing like this. On the other hand, is that ever sustainable to like have to play the best teams in the NFL protecting your quarterback?
It's well,
So this is the thing, right?
If Breeze keeps putting up 60 grades, there's going to be a game where they score 9 points again like they did against the Falcons last year.
What's interesting is, so the boss incurred your wrath by incorrectly crediting GMFB for the hypnotizer. We apparently are differing. He was much more bullish about Drew Brees and his arm strength and all those kinds of things than we've been, right? Or at least I've been. And he was saying, look, as long as the accuracy is there, it's not a big problem, right? This offense is designed around getting these guys in space and yards after the catch. To his credit, that part was back this week.
Like, oh, yeah. He was
the first couple of weeks, yeah. Drew Brees' accuracy was concerning. And where I differ with Chris is I think they're linked. Like, I don't think his accuracy has disappeared independent of the fact that his arm is on the wane. I think because his arm is on the wane, his accuracy is declining because suddenly, like, he drops back and it's muscle memory, right? You throw the ball to a guy over the middle, 10 yards, you have an inbuilt, just inbuilt knowledge of how hard and fast to throw that ball. And that lands it right in the guy's eye, right? That's where you always aimed. Eye level, catch it, perfect. Now it's not. Now it's dropping at like waist height for the same throw. The muscle memory is leading to a different result because his arm isn't what it used to be. And you don't catch up with that mentally in the time it takes for you to decline. Like you're always behind the curve. So I think his accuracy is declining because of the arm strength. On the other hand, in this game, he was accurate enough that it works, right? But the other area that I think is concerning is I don't think running an offense through a guy's ability to break tackles after the catch is a long-term sustainable thing. Like, you can look at it and it works last night and you say, look, Kamara is amazing and what he's doing is phenomenal and he might very well be the best running back in the NFL. But that doesn't feel like a game plan that works throughout the playoffs against the best defenses in the NFL long-term.
Average depth of target, 4.4 yesterday. A little bit lower than his, on the season, he's under six. I mean, no, I don't think that's sustainable.
Yeah.
The fact that he's still putting up ridiculous numbers. I mean, it was garbage time numbers against the Raiders. And yesterday's inflated, 65% of his yards coming after the catch and ridiculous Kamara plays. So the production's still there. I'm with you. It's not sustainable. I'm also I have to stick with what I said last week. Like, I'm not ready to write him off because they've shown that they can produce this stuff. And he just needs to, like, Peyton would throw, like, end over end dig routes for 20 yards. Like, I still think Breeze hasn't even hit that phase yet. He still has the phase where the ball looks way worse than it even does now, and it still kind of gets there.
You're not ready to write him off, but you're a step closer than you were last week.
Yeah, because, you went back to last year. Here are his last six game grades. 61, 53, 62, 57, 63, 61.
Yeah.
It went from PFF, PSV2, check it out with PFF Elite. It's a sea of green and blue. And now it's yellow and orange.
It's
caution, caution, caution.
It's the plays he's still making that are not where they need to be that are the problem, right? There was a pass that Emmanuel Sanders caught from being sitting on the ground, like in the middle of a split, because the ball was underthrown by like 2 yards, right? It was like an out pattern from, I can't remember which hash it was from, but it was like a deep out. And that ball was 2 yards underthrown. So Emmanuel Sanders has to hit the ground, pick it up off the turf.
Right.
Whereas in theory, that should be a routine, easy completion. Now, they still caught it because the coverage wasn't as good, right? But if that guy's tighter, suddenly the fact that that's 2 yards underthrown is a problem.
I don't mind those, though. Those are the ones where it's like he's thrown it a little bit early. He's old and protected himself from any sort of pressure. He could throw it early, just throw it up there and let a guy make a play. I don't mind those as much. I want the seams back, a go ball every now and again. They are limited at that point down the field, and that would be the biggest concern for Breeze. I don't mind the throw it early and let Sanders make the play on a comeback.
I just think those are becoming a problem, right? Because he catches it like that. Sometimes he's not going to. Sometimes the DB is going to be closer and it's not caught because it's contested or it's broken up. Sometimes it's bringing these guys back beyond the first down marker, which when your average depth of target...
That has happened a few times.
Which when your average depth of target is 4 yards is a bigger problem than it is when your average depth of target is 9 yards, right? Like if you're picking this thing up in tiny increments, if you cost yourself first downs by underthrowing the ball, you don't have that margin for error. Again, the more of a problem his arm is, the smaller his margin for error, and you're taking away margin by the arm strength.
The other issue for the Saints, a 32.8 coverage grade, including really good players like Marcus Williams, Marshawn Lattimore, Malcolm Jenkins, and then PJ Williams on his six coverage snaps, all grading in the 30s. That's the bigger. I mean, look, you say whatever you want about the right arm of Drew Brees. If this defense continues to play like this and the way they played against the Raiders, Saints have no shot. And that's it. Tom Brady and the Bucs are in first place in the NFC South. But on the good, you know, good news for the Saints, they still get to play the Panthers and the Broncos and some of the teams that, you know, the Bucs just got to play. So
yeah, I mean, it's such a weird evaluation because they're 1-2. They've been putting up points the whole way. But again, the standard for them is, are they the best team in the NFL because they're shooting for a Super Bowl?
They don't look like
And right now, they don't look like the best team in the NFL, nor do they look capable of getting to the point of being the best team in the NFL, which is why the analysis on them sounds so negative, because they're being judged on a different scale than everybody else.
All right, that'll do it for week three. Of course, Monday Night Football, maybe the game of the week.
Yeah.
Kansas City Chiefs and the Baltimore Ravens. For full analysis on that, be sure to go back and listen to our week three preview or go to YouTube. We actually have an actual Chiefs-Ravens full-on video carved out just previewing the game. So go check that out. And, of course, go check out all the grades at Premium Stats 2.0 at PFF.com. It's PFF Elite. That is the package that you want, because all these great grades and numbers that we have, they're all in there. So go check it out. We'll be back on Thursday. Do we have a special guest this week? Are we doing this?
Yeah.
Robert Mays?
Yes.
This week?
I believe so.
Robert Mays, now of The Athletic, I believe.
Yeah. The Athletic Football Podcast now. Right?
Yeah. In The Athletic Football Podcast. He's going to be our special guest on Thursday. So we're going to preview all the action and have Robert Mays, an action-packed episode this week. So be sure to download and subscribe wherever you're listening to this. Thanks to everybody. Enjoy Monday Night Football. We'll see you guys for a week four preview on Thursday. Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.